Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
Hi, I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup.
So every day the shutdown continues to grow is another day that there will be a backlog.
This week, we're looking at the unexpected ways the government shutdown has impacted our food system.
There are nearly 1.6 million New Yorkers who rely on SNAP to feed themselves and their families every single day. There is a real impact on our friends and neighbors.
A lot of farmers rely on commodity loans at the end of the year. Since the offices are not open, those loans aren't available to them.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's MEAT plus sign THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
Hey, gang, just a quick programming note before we jump into this week's show. The episode that you're about to listen to, if you've looked at the timing, is a long episode. But I suggest instead of looking at it that way, that you look at it as four short episodes packed together. I spent some time at the Cayman Cookout this past weekend and was lucky to interview some of the biggest names in the industry, spanning a couple of generations, everyone from Amanda Cohen of Dirt Candy to Dominique Kren of Atelier Kren and other restaurants in San Francisco, to Eric Repair of Le Bernardin, to Emeril Lagasse, to Nancy Silverton. It just goes on and on. It's four interviews. I suggest you treat them like you might a book of short stories or a magazine and enjoy them one at a time. Keep them in your queue and listen to them at your leisure. And with that, I hope you enjoy this special report that I am calling the Cayman Chronicles. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. As you can probably tell from the background noise, we are at the beach. We are in the Cayman Islands. We are on Grand Cayman. More specifically, we were at the Ritz-Carlton Grand Cayman, which has been the site for the last, what do we say, maybe 4 days of the Cayman Cookout, which is an annual event down here. It's put together by the hotel. It's sort of lorded over or presented by, as they say, Chef Eric Repair, whose restaurant Blue is on the property here. And I was a guest here along with several representatives of the media, one of whom is sitting with me. Can you say hello, mystery guest?
Hello.
How are you this morning?
I'm excellent. Very, very happy to be here and not in a cold place.
The cold place, which is where you are based.
Which is where I'm based, the cold place of Chicago.
So our mystery guest, who is... Listeners, longtime listeners know when I'm on the road, I often invite somebody to do these intros with me because of my disability as a podcast host that I cannot do an intro by myself. I do sometimes, but it's always better with another person here. Our mystery guest is Meredith Heil.
Good pronunciation.
Thank you. Meredith, tell people what you do. You're based in, recently relocated to Chicago.
Recently relocated to Chicago from New York. I'm a journalist.
Yeah,
I focus mostly on drinks. I do some food and travel as well.
Yeah. So this one for me was, I should say, we have been guests of the event. We were flown in. We were put up very nicely. Our meals were covered. This is not something I'm all that used to, but I've spent some time, I was sort of embedded in the world of travel writers for the last few days. I know that's only part of what you do, but this travel writer gig can be pretty sweet.
Yeah, it's good work if you can get it, for sure. Yeah.
Because we have been wined and dined and put up in very nice quarters and invited to beach barbecues and whatnot. It's been quite sweet. So anyway, we're getting ready to leave. We're speaking to you Monday morning, January 21st. It's Martin Luther King Day. We are both returning to our respective homes today. But we are sitting for the last time on the beach. We are watching the waves crash on the shore. And we're going to introduce the show. Just to put it in context, the Cayman Cookout, now in its 11th year. Had you been here before?
No, first time.
Pretty well run?
Yeah, it was a tight ship for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, so many things going on, but everything was kept.
Like a Swiss Army
exactly.
knife.
Exactly.
Or not us, like a Swiss watch.
Like a Swiss watch.
Sorry. I was my
like
head.
Sharp, like a Swiss Army
My head
Army
is
knife.
Still in the culinary realm. It's,
yeah.
But no, all the events start on time, all the sound works, everything
yeah.
starts with like a tray of drinks being passed.
There totally, were totally.
Some spectacular meals by the guest chefs. And the chefs here this week, it was Eric Repair, who's always been here and part of this, mm-hmm. Emeril Lagasse, who's a regular, Andrew Zimmern, Amanda Cohen for the first time from Dirt Candy, a friend of the show's. Emma Benson from Aquavit, another friend of the show's. Nancy Silverton for the first time from Los Angeles.
Oh, that was her first time?
First time.
Oh, wow.
I refer to Nancy as the high priestess of pasta and pastry.
Yeah, she's amazing. Those grilled
LA
cheeses.
County. Yeah, there were grilled cheeses.
That grilled cheese was
last night.
Out of this world.
Although I'm told those were not, she didn't make them. They might have been her recipe.
Oh, really? From last night?
Yeah.
But she made the ones at the beach bash.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, but
I think that's correct.
You weren't there.
I wasn't there.
Yeah. I can tell you they were amazing.
Gosh, who am I forgetting? Who was here? Oh, Dominique Crenn. Yeah, it was quite the assemblage. So I was able to arrange four interviews, which I'm going to present to you in this Cayman Chronicles episode of the show. And they are going to be Eric Repair, an interview with Dominique Crenn, an interview with Nancy Silverton.
Oh, you forgot Jose Andres.
Jose Andres.
How could you forget?
You know, because I couldn't get an interview with him.
I heard he was not doing interviews.
Yeah,
it wasn't
think,
you.
I don't think he did any, but I read his book on the flight down. One of these days I'm going to get him.
He was too busy having a good time.
Yeah, well, he deserves it. Yep. He deserves it. He's, as somebody called him this weekend, a Spanish saint. In any event, I have a little roundtable interview with Amanda Cohen, Andrew Zimmern, and Emeril Lagasse, where we just do some sort of industry shop talk. But the first interview, I was lucky to sit down with Chef Eric Repair, of course, the chef of the 3-star Michelin Le Bernardin in New York City, one of the best restaurants in the U.S.
One of the best restaurants in the world, I would venture to say.
In the world. Definitely one of the best, maybe the best seafood restaurant anywhere. Have you ever met Eric?
I have met him, yeah.
How does he strike you?
Very kind.
Yeah,
very
right?
polite.
Yeah.
Very put together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Calm.
Full package.
Centered.
Yep.
You know, and he's not, you know, sometimes you see chefs at that caliber in the public and they're just the most gregarious people. And then behind the scenes, they're like these awful divas, like almost like you'd see in a movie. He is not that person. He is a real soulful, sweet, gentle person.
I still would not want to mess with him. I would not want to cross him.
Well, you know, there was an interview with Dan Holtzman, who created the meatball shop, I don't know, a couple of months ago on the show. I forget what the number was. But Dan had interned. This was a different time in New York. I don't think you could do this now. When he was 14 years old, he interned in the Le Bernardin kitchen.
Wow.
And described Eric pre-Buddhism. And he fit the old model a little bit more.
More of an angry chef.
More of a mean chef. And actually, that came up. It's in his memoir, and it came up in this interview that we did. So this is a good segue. But Eric helped create this event. He's been in charge of it for years. It's also sort of a bittersweet occasion this year because his friend Tony Bourdain obviously died about 7 months ago.
Months already.
Tony had come to all of these events and been a part of them. And there's a lot of, I would guesstimate, they had people raise their hands the other day, you know, who's been here before. I would guesstimate at least half the people here, the guests, have been here before. So Tony's a part of their experience here
Definitely.
As well. They had a talk one day about Tony, which I actually wrote about on my blog, Tokeland, which I never plug here, but I have started blogging again. Tokueland is where that blog lives, if you want to read that article. Anyway, I think that's all I really need to say about this interview with Eric. This took place on day two of the Cayman Cookout. And without any further ado, here you go. My interview with Chef Eric Repair. First of all, would love to ask you some logistical questions.
Sure.
Because I think it's fascinating. You have a 3-star Michelin restaurant in New York City.
Yes.
It's also a 4-star New York Times restaurant. But you have some relationships outside of New York, and one of them is with this hotel.
Yes, in Cayman Islands.
In the Cayman Islands, the Ritz-Carlton. So how long, I know this event is in its 11th year, how long has your relationship with this hotel been going on? And what is it like when a chef like you takes on a relationship with a project that's technically in another country? It's not that far away. It's closer than California.
Much closer.
Yeah, it's only a 4-hour flight. But what's it like for you? Could you just speak to this generically for a moment?
Sure. My first contact with the Ritz-Carlton in Cayman Island was 15 years ago.
Okay.
And I came here when the hotel was being built.
Yep.
They picked me up at the airport, took me on the boat. I went to Stingray City, swam with the stingrays, and I was like in heaven. And then they started to talk business. And I was not even listening. I was like, where do I sign, right?
But when they brought you here, was that the purpose? Was that a seduction?
I think it was.
It wasn't announced as that, though. But that
No. We were talking.
Yeah.
Do you want to have a restaurant in the Cayman Island?
Yeah.
And do you want to be in a Ritz-Carlton?
Yes.
And then I decided that was a good idea.
Yeah.
And we were about to open when it was a big hurricane in the Cayman. So we delayed the project by 1 more year. And we opened 13 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Blue by Eric Ripert.
Yeah.
And 11 years ago, we decided to have Cayman Cookout.
Okay, so 2 years in.
Yes, 2 years in. And we are basically running Cayman Cookout as well, and it's a food and wine festival on the beach with friends.
Mm-hmm. Is that the main criteria for who comes here? People you know, people you personally like?
There are people that I know, there are people that I admire, people that I like. Yes, it's very intimate. Mm-hmm. We have a bunch of friends, and we are on the beach interacting with people.
Yeah.
It's like you notice, I mean, it's small groups. It's not a huge festival.
Yeah.
And we want to keep it like that. We want to keep the chefs being excited to come.
Yeah.
And bring their family and have the children playing on the beach. And,
mm-hmm.
and people being able to interact with the chef, which is... It's not easy when you have big festivals.
No, it's tough. It can be... Well, you use the word overwhelming, but it can be just a pain. it can be not fun just to get around and waiting in lines. And
so here is no lines.
Yeah, no lines.
No lines.
I don't want to name names, but I was at a festival last year. I think they've been doing it for a long time now. But like, if you just wanted to get something at a tasting station, you had to wait like 40 minutes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It was crazy.
Yes. Here it's immediate.
Mm-hmm.
You go to the class and you enter in the tent, you're on the beach.
Yeah.
If you do a wine tasting, it's very small groups.
Yeah.
Then we have bigger events. Tonight, Jose Andres and I are hosting a barbecue on the beach.
Yes, looking forward
and
to
it's,
it.
It's going to be a few hundred people,
yeah.
But it's no lines.
Yeah.
You wait 3 minutes and you have your food. It's nice.
Yeah. So can I get personal for a minute?
Can we?
You know, I don't know if you remember years ago, I gave you, my late mother-in-law was a painter, and she had done a series of tarot paintings. Do you remember this? I came to dinner with the Waltucks.
Yes, absolutely.
And I gave you a portfolio.
Yes.
You sent her a beautiful note, by the way.
21 Taras.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
I'm just curious, because I've mentioned to you, I interviewed Dan Holtzman, who came to work for you as a teenager. He definitely perceived in you, I mean, religion is a very personal thing.
Yes.
You are, am I phrasing it correctly, a practicing Buddhist?
Yes, I do.
But that is something that came into your life as an adult.
Yes, I was already in America, actually.
Yeah, and at Le Bernardin.
At Le Bernardin, yeah. Absolutely.
How did that affect you as a chef, as a manager, as someone in a very stressful business, in a very stressful city, and then when Michelin finally came to New York, with a lot on the line every year... How does that set of teachings and practices affect your professional orientation?
I think the practice and the teachings affect much more than my profession. They affect me in my personal life.
I'm sure.
And my profession is part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the way I see phenomenons appearing in my life are is very different than previously. And the way I handle stress and I handle crisis and good moments and is very different than previously as well. Ultimately, at the end of the day, it brings peace into my life. It mm-hmm. brings a certain perspective. And really, you know, it's my religion is in my heart.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, for me, it's Buddhism, but it could be anyone saying that.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a compassionate approach to life,
yeah.
when you know that life is impermanent,
yes.
and nothing is going to last the way it is, and many other things, you are much more relaxed. And obviously, it has some positive consequences on your interaction with your family, your mm-hmm. friends, your surrounding,
mm-hmm.
and obviously at work with the team, of course.
Mm-hmm. It made you a more, how do we say it, a kinder, gentler manager?
For sure. Yeah.
I read your book.
Yes, I used to be a very mean chef when I was young. I had a temper, and of course I had very high demands. And I made a mistake that I thought anger was, because when you're angry, you have a lot of strength.
Mm.
And I thought being angry was, in a kitchen, was
power,
a quality almost. And I realized it was a weakness. And when you realize that,
yeah.
you change everything
mm-hmm.
to fight that weakness.
Mm-hmm.
And today I'm very happy with the changes that I have made. And I'm very happy to see people working at Le Bernardin in a very peaceful environment, as much as we can, obviously. Sometimes we have some tense moments.
Of course.
Of course.
Yeah.
But, if, you know, it's a different world.
Yeah.
And I want to make sure that all the team in the kitchen, in offices, the stewards, the waiters,
yeah.
work in harmony together and have pleasure and are not working in fear, I don't know, of being yelled at or being punished or being humiliated.
Mm-hmm.
I think someone who's reinforced in his passion will do a much better job than someone who's scared.
Yeah. Did that disposition that you used to have, you know, you wrote in your book about your time with your mentor. I think you actually used the word mentor.
Yes.
About Robuchon.
For sure, Joël Robuchon.
Yeah, but you also talk about how demanding he could be. And
yes.
I don't mean any disrespect, but I think I would probably even, like the bathroom chart on the wall, I think you could even say how petty he could be at times. Maybe that's
he
not
was
a word you would use.
He was very detail-oriented.
You would put it that way. Okay. But if people who haven't read the book, which I highly recommend, there's a story in there. You'll know what I mean when you get to it. But were you that kind of a person as a young person? See, what I've always thought about chefs who can be a mean chef, as you say you used to be,
yes.
is usually, you know, they say the people who are most likely to become child abusers are people who were abused themselves. And I feel like a lot of times the people who become mean chefs are people who were professionally raised in an environment like that. They weren't necessarily temperamental in their personal life. They weren't necessarily given to anger or that kind of display in their personal life. But they were raised in a professional kitchen by a mentor who's almost like a deity,
almost God.
Yeah, and so you adopt those behaviors. That becomes yes. the way you see that as the way to do it. Was that the case for you?
Yes,
were you a gentle person personally?
I think I'm gentle. However, I know that I had a temper when I was young,
even personally.
Personally, yes.
Okay.
But I was becoming mean by my training.
Mm-hmm.
In the kitchen.
So that aspect of your personality was being reinforced.
It was basically being reinforced.
Yeah.
At the same time, we're talking about the 1980s.
Right.
I don't know in America how it was in the 80s, but in France, parents had no regrets to smack their son or daughter in public because of misbehavior.
Yeah.
Being kicked in the butt was something that was happening with your teacher in school.
Mm-hmm.
They were pulling our ears. They were pulling our hair.
Mm-hmm.
The society was very different.
Yeah.
And therefore, I think what was happening in the kitchens was consequences of already that education that was trickling down
yeah.
into the workplace.
Is it still that way in France?
I don't think so. I think it has changed a lot.
It was the same way for me, and I grew up in Florida.
Yes.
I feel like I'm home, by the way, sitting here. This is very much. You spent time in Florida.
Of course.
Yeah. I once, Richard Holoku.
Yes.
I think he was with you in Florida. He used to manage the Gotham Bar and Grill. And he once in a while told me, I think you two opened up an offshoot, yes, of Le Bernardin?
Yes, it was called Brasserie Le Cause in 1991.
In Florida.
In Coconut Grove.
And the only detail I remember him telling me was that he said Eric needed a lot of coffee in the morning.
I did need a lot of coffee because I was working 18 hours a day.
Right.
And 6 days a week.
Yeah, yeah. That's like fuel.
It was, yes. Yeah. It was my fuel.
Yeah. So how for you, you know, you've been associated with Le Bernardin for a long time now.
Started in 1991, yes.
How has, I mean, other than your, you know, your own elevation, other than the fact that we now have the Michelin Guide in the United States, day to day.
Yes.
For a restaurant that's been at the pinnacle of dining in New York for so long. Mm. And for people listening who don't know, Gilbert Le Cause was the chef originally.
Yes.
He owned the restaurant with his sister, Maggie.
Yes.
And then he sadly passed away.
In 1994.
Very young. And then you became the chef of that restaurant.
Yes.
But it's been at the height of cutting edge modern French cuisine, specifically seafood in the United States forever. But how has within those parameters,
yes,
what's changed over the years for you? Or does it feel like one unbroken line to you?
In terms of my...
Anything, in terms of your style, in terms of how you run the place, in terms of the customer base?
So I do not get influenced by the outside world at all.
Culinary.
Culinary world, media world.
Trends, all of that.
Trends.
That doesn't affect you.
It doesn't affect me at all. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm not naive, and I know the consequences of losing a star, and I know the consequences of getting stars or getting rewards. I'm not naive about that. But I do not think about it during the year, except maybe the night before you get your results or before you get your review. But I am absolutely not affected by it. I'm being inspired by my own experience. I'm lucky to live in New York because in New York, as you know very well, we are surrounded by so many different cultures that are fantastic, and we see so many different ingredients for chefs and learn the techniques, and it's a source of inspiration, constant source of inspiration. At the same time, I am lucky that I can travel and I can go to countries that inspire me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I come back, I integrate in our cooking and in our way of hospitality as well, which is rooted in the French culture. But I basically mix my culture with the other cultures that I have experienced. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of managing the restaurant with the employees, I follow my moral compass. And I know what's right and what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to do my best to make them happy.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, it's a win-win because people are very grateful and they give back. And my life is very peaceful. I have no pressure at all from the outside world except the fact that the outside world inspires me.
Mm-hmm. What do you bring in terms of influence, right, which you just mentioned?
Yes.
Beyond actual food, like as you said, New York City, there's every kind of food imaginable. I can imagine you might go to dinner I don't know where you eat, but I can imagine you going to an ethnic restaurant in Queens and maybe getting, you know, an idea to use a certain chili or a certain herb in your cooking. But what about non-culinary? How does the city affect you in ways maybe that you can't even communicate? Do you feel like just living in New York has affected what you do?
No doubt about it.
Just the energy. Well, how would you describe it?
Because New York is one of a kind. I don't know any other city in the world that has the energy of New York.
Yeah.
The pace of New York, so it's all, as we know, fast pace, high energy. New York attracts talents from all over the world.
Not just culinary.
Not just culinary.
You're talking about culturally.
Talking about talents culturally.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to be in New York.
Mm.
Young people dream is to come to New York and to show what they can do and to share with the New York community their passion. And this is like very rewarding for us New Yorkers.
Yeah.
Of course, we get tired sometimes because the pace is very fast, and when you age and you're not 20 anymore, it's tiring. But you take a break, you go to the countryside, you come back, you take a long weekend, you come back, and you're back in that city that is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's something happening everywhere, every hour, every minute. Mm-hmm. And
but how does that manifest itself in what you do in the restaurant? Or can't you put words to it?
Well, obviously it manifests in some ways. At the restaurant, I always want to reinvent or more like rejuvenate ourselves. I always want to question what we are doing and try to do something better because it's competition, and I love competition. Competition is not a negative thing. It's positive. If you are by yourself and no one is doing something, you don't get inspired. You get lazy.
Yeah.
And then what happens? Instead of progressing, you regress.
Yeah.
In New York, you cannot be passive.
Right.
You have to be active. If you are passive, well, then you know it's time to leave the city.
Right. Yeah. If I take that and combine it with what you said earlier about your disposition,
yes,
I would say that that's not so much competition for you as motivation. Like, you're surrounded. Like, for example, I need to belong to a gym, right? I cannot. Years ago, our mutual friend Alfred Portales said to me,
yes,
because I was starting to run, and he said, you have to join a gym because when you join a gym, you're surrounded by other people who are doing the same thing you're doing, and that is motivating.
Yes.
So I take what you just said, not like you don't want to crush the other people.
No,
you're happy for them to succeed. That's competition.
And the beauty of New York,
I think you find it motivating.
It's motivation.
Is that
you're
correct?
Right. It's motivation because obviously I don't want to hurt anyone. I don't want to.
You don't want your success to come at the cost of someone else's success.
I don't want to create shadow for someone else.
Right.
At the contrary, and the luck that we have in New York, it's space for everyone.
Yeah.
And if you are good at what you do,
yeah,
and diligent,
yeah,
and disciplined, you are going to succeed.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's something that you don't have to worry about hurting people or creating shadow.
Yep. You know, I want to bring this up. I know you and your friends, Andrew and Jose, are going to talk about Tony Bourdain tomorrow. We're sitting here on Friday. You know, I'm one of many people who knew him a little bit, who he was extremely generous to.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, actually, the day he died, Bill Telepan and I spontaneously did an episode of this show where we just talked about him for half an hour. But I have to tell you, for someone I did not know that well, when I arrived here, I find the ocean to be very powerful.
Yes, it is very powerful.
It is. You were talking before about realizing your days are numbered. You're limited, right?
Yes.
There is something about the ocean that puts you in mind of life, that puts you in mind of mortality, that puts you in mind of how insignificant you are, right?
Yes, absolutely.
The last two nights, I've had dreams, and I've never had one before, about Tony.
Oh, that's interesting.
Who I didn't know very well. And they weren't very dramatic dreams. It was like talking to him. You know, he was a part of this event. He was obviously your good friend.
Yes, Anthony participated with José Andrés to the 11 Cayman cookout
that we
have created.
Yeah,
and
that's
we used
a loyal
to have,
friend.
And we used to have our children very young with us.
Yes.
And it was, for Anthony, it was really like a vacation with family. And he was with his daughter, who was playing with my son on the beach. And Anthony would, in between the events, go and play and do sandcastles. And it was really a lot of fun. And then the festival evolved. Our children grew up.
Yeah.
But we were still on the beach having fun, like a family vacation.
Yeah. So is this, you know, I know other chefs have said to me that they feel him here this year. They feel his absence here very profoundly this year. This isn't going to air till after the festival. I don't want to bring the festival down, and then you won't do it again for a year. But what's the emotion like for you of being? I mean, it must be on your mind being here again.
Of course, we miss Anthony, and he was again a big part of the festival, and a dear friend, of Jose, and a very dear friend of mine,
yeah.
And we miss his presence, life goes on, and the festival is a bit different. Mm-hmm. And this year we are paying homage to Anthony. We are paying homage to his legacy.
Yeah,
we are not crying.
Yeah, you're celebrating his life.
We're celebrating his life.
This that's is what, like when that people.
That's what we are doing during the entire festival. In little bits here and there. This morning, Jose at the Paella and pay a huge homage to Anthony, and everybody was laughing and upbeat. Mm-hmm. And this is what we are doing this year.
Yeah.
We know Anthony is not physically with us.
Yes,
some of us believe that he's in spirit with us and bring us the sun and the beautiful weather.
You believe that?
Of course.
Yeah,
and
that's a beautiful thought.
Again, we have 3 days of celebrations.
Yes.
Celebrations for everyone, but also thinking about him and his legacy.
Yeah. What for you is it? I mean, for me, his there are two main things for me. I write about chefs, right? I tell people I'm a chef writer, not a food writer. I have said for years, not just after he passed away, for years I have said that I don't believe my career would be possible the way what it is without him having his career. I think he made it possible for someone like me to say, I'm not a food writer. I specialize in chefs.
Yes.
Right? I credit him with that. I'm sorry I never told him that, but I really do believe that. I think I would just be writing recipes, which I did for a little while.
And it's okay to do that too.
That's fine. No, for me, I'm happier, but for other people, that's fine. A lot of my best friends do that. And I also feel like he had a willingness to stand up for people. I believe he had a willingness to call out immorality, to call out cruelty, to call out people
anything
who are
anything
that was hypocritical.
Right.
Yes.
Absolutely. He had zero tolerance for hypocritical behaviors.
Yeah.
He always defended the weak.
Yes.
The small guy.
Yes.
He brought all of us to destinations that we never thought existed.
Mm-hmm.
It changed completely the way journalism covers our industry because he was the first one to go in the streets and eat in the middle of the market or from a street vendor.
Yeah.
And we were learning the culture from that aspect.
Yes.
And he was the first one to say, don't sit your ass in a chair for 2 weeks in a resort and look at the sea and go back home. Don't be lazy.
Right.
Go out and you're going to have fun and you're going to discover so many things. And you're going to discover that we're all the same.
Yeah.
We all want happiness.
Yes.
And the world is actually not that big and it's not so much, so many difference in between cultures.
Yeah.
And he brought people together.
Yes.
And that is really the legacy that he left behind.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely the legacy that we are honoring during the festival.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I think we're just about out of time. I know you have you're very much in demand here at your festival. I guess that comes with the territory, Chef. I just have to say, we don't know each other well, but every time I see you, you're such a gregarious person. For someone, it's not necessarily something one expects from a 3-star Michelin, 4-star. You know what I mean? We don't have to name names, but you have always been such a gentleman, and it's great to be down here and seeing this festival that I've been watching on, social media for so long.
Well, I'm very happy that you are part of it.
Thank you.
It's definitely a pleasure to have you at the festival, and always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Chef.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
How about that? That was Chef Eric Repair, making time for us in the midst of the craziness, the organized craziness of the Cayman Cookout. We have 4 interviews today, so we're not going to a break. We are instead going to go directly into the next interview we did. And that interview is with Chef Dominique Kren, another 3-star Michelin chef, a little more newly minted 3-star Michelin chef than
That's
Eric,
right.
but a 3-star Michelin chef nonetheless. And how about Dominique? Did you know Dominique before Meredith?
She is amazing. She's the only female 3-star Michelin, correct?
Yes.
In the world.
I believe that's correct.
Yeah, she is just, she's a boss.
Had you met her before?
I had never met her before, no.
Yeah. Is she loose and fun enough for you?
I didn't really talk with her.
Oh, my God.
But She seemed at her demo, she was very much out there, you know, talking to people, very bubbly and very interactive. But then I heard in the interview she's a little bit more reserved. Is that correct?
She can be reserved in the interview, but it's funny. The picture people will see on the episode page and on Instagram, she makes, you know, this really kooky face. For people who have never seen her, she's very she's distinct looking, but not like in a crazy, she's not like punk or anything, but she has kind of punked hair.
Got style.
She's got incredible style. Yeah. She's an amazing dresser, and her energy socially, you know, twice when I was interviewing Nancy Silverton, Dominique, you know, did like a flyby.
Oh, did she?
Yeah. Like a, what do you call it? A barn, you know, like with the old biplanes when they...
She barnstormed our interview.
Yes. or interview she bombed. She interview bombed us.
Podcast bombed?
Yes. Pod bombed us.
Pod bombed, yeah.
She just kind of, she's definitely goes to her own beat. I don't know her well. I love her. I've interviewed her before. When I interviewed her for my book a couple of years ago, she showed up to a restaurant in San Francisco with her little dog, Maximus.
Nice.
Who sat in her lap all through our lunch and interview.
I can definitely picture that.
And that's her. She just kind of goes her own way. This interview, you know, I didn't know what we were going to do. And then I realized when we sat down, the best way to interview Dominique Crenn is to just kind of say, what's up, you know, what do you want to talk about?
Let her
guide. There's always
it.
Something.
Yeah.
And this interview was all over the place from what kind of kid she was. She proactively brought up the topic of women's issues in the industry. I also need to apologize to Dominique Crenn because, you know, they had us very tightly scheduled with these chefs. And when the interview was over, she said, why is it over? And I said, because that's what we have. We traded cell phone numbers. I was going to look her up again. And as you know, this is a place where time just kind of... And I saw her last night, and she said, did you ever write me to do the interview? And I said, no. I felt really dumb.
Oh, we're all busy. This is why it runs like a tight ship.
I know. But if you're going to do that to somebody, Dominique Crenn's, I don't think she'll hold a grudge.
No.
Okay.
Dominique, I think she's got a lot going on.
Next time I come to San Francisco, we'll do part two of this interview.
With the dog.
With Maximus. Yeah. She wanted to bring Maximus. There was some reason she said it wasn't, she couldn't do it. Maybe customs. I don't know. In any event, this is my conversation with Chef Dominique Crenn, recorded here at the Ritz-Carlton at the Cayman Cookout on Grand Cayman in the Cayman Islands. Here you go. I just had a 5-course wine-paired lunch. This is my first interview of the day, and I thought, thank God I have Dominique Crenn, because that will wake me up.
Are you drunk?
I'm not drunk. I'm sleepy. I had a few espressos before I came down.
Yeah, you have to.
You have to. So you are, how many times have you done this event?
Second.
Oh, it's only your second time?
Yeah, second year. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I did it last year. I think the reason why I've been doing a lot of things like this is to bring the restaurant to other, you know, area and talk about it. And but it's exhausting.
Is it exhausting?
Yeah,
because one of my questions for you was, whenever I see you, even right now, you're sitting up straight. You're obviously.
I am. I think I was. Hold on. Let me do it.
What are you doing?
I was like, she's like.
No, you're good.
Okay, I'm good.
Okay.
They're looking at me now.
I know.
I'm trying not.
There's a lot of people watching us here.
Yes.
So you, every time I see you, you're like this ball of energy. We just took a picture. You made a crazy face. You seem to have a ton of natural energy. You seem to be a naturally energetic person.
I do.
Do you have to work at that?
No, not at all. It's just like it's natural,
but it's
exhausting.
You mean when the day is over, you're exhausted?
Well, I think not physically, but I think sometimes emotionally.
Yeah,
it's just so much
up and down.
No, it's just so much question and words and at the end of the day, you just want to be like on the water, looking at the waves.
Yeah, not thinking.
Not thinking and just. Just enjoy.
Yeah.
Like be.
Yeah.
And it's, I think that I realized, I mean, this year I realized that I need that balance.
That's new for you?
A little bit.
Yeah. Yes. You're used to just go, go, go.
I just go, go, go.
Yeah.
Now I have a great team.
Uh-huh. Two restaurants?
No, three.
What's the third? What did I?
Bakren.
Oh, Bakren. I'm sorry.
Yeah, yes. It's okay.
Yeah, and Petit Crenn.
Petit Crenn.
Yeah.
Atelier Crane, Bar Crane. Yeah, yeah. We have a farm also. Mm-hmm. And then we're opening a new concept, Boutique Crane, at the end of the year.
Oh, my gosh. At the end of the year? So it's like 12 months from now, end of the year?
It's more like 9 months.
Okay.
Yes. Well, that if it works, I don't know. You know.
It usually means 12 months.
Bureaucracy.
At least in New York. I don't know about where you are. But.
Well, I mean, we've been working on that project for almost 2 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, bureaucracy and get this permit, this and that. And I was like, oh.
So can we talk for a minute? We've had this conversation. Last time I interviewed you, your friend Maximus was with you.
Yes. We couldn't bring him.
Oh, really? You wanted to?
I wanted to.
Okay.
It was too complicated, you know.
Maximus is a dog, just so everyone knows. But you came to the last interview we did with a dog.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But
excuse me. Maximus.
Yes.
Julius Caesar Crane.
Forgive me. No disrespect. Don't tell him I got it wrong.
Yes. He's about 11 years old. Okay. He was a rescue. I rescued him in 2008.
Yeah.
And then he's been I don't know, at my side, and mm-hmm. he's also been Atelier Crane mm-hmm. mascot.
Yeah, I love that
for sure.
So can you just talk to me about, because I have fallen in love with California in the last few years, because I was writing this book, I interviewed you for it, I came out like a dozen times, sure. six times to San Francisco, six times to LA. I don't think I've ever heard anyone describe their arrival to California in a way that I so identified with. Can you just tell the story of why you came to the United States originally and how California struck you when you got there?
Well, United States is one thing. Mm-hmm. California is another thing. Mm-hmm. And San Francisco
is yet another thing.
It's another thing.
Okay.
I grew up in an incredible, with an incredible family. I grew up in an incredible country, but I felt that perhaps my voice or what I wanted to do was not going to happen right away. Mm-hmm. France is a great country, but very bureaucratic. And I'm like, kind of like, you know, I want to do my own thing.
And very tradition bound.
Very
right?
traditional, yes.
Yeah.
And this is nothing wrong about this. It's just it didn't fit with my...
it didn't sync up with your sensibility.
And with my persona. Yeah. It's just like I need to... I'm curious. I always want to do things. And I don't want anyone to put rules on me. Mm-hmm. Came to California. The first time I came here was in L.A. Mm-hmm. Didn't like it.
Why not?
I felt that it was too much driving. And I was not connecting with what LA should have been. But I have to tell you that years later, I've moved to Los Angeles and I loved it. Mm-hmm. So then I'm like, I don't know. And then my dad knew someone in San Francisco in the course of like a business training. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, I want to go and hang out there and see, you know, if I like it. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love.
At first sight.
At first sight, at the airport.
Yeah, this is what I remember. What happened? You got there, you got off the plane.
I don't know. I got off the plane, and this is, you know, it's in time, and I think, I know that it happened to every human, I mean, most of the human being. There is a sense of, there's this feeling that come within you that's just like, I'm home. And I don't know. I don't know where that come from. It's just I felt home. I was still at the airport. I've never seen the city before.
Amazing.
And then I started to discover San Francisco, and San Francisco is very special. It's mm-hmm. Obviously this is a city that, I don't know, is in front of a lot of things, new thing, innovation, and mm-hmm. but also a city that has welcomed diversity through the years.
Always.
And I said that to someone before. I think that San Francisco have been a city, so also California, kind of like remove from everyone.
Yeah,
we talk about New York, we talk about Chicago, and then we move down to somewhere else.
Yeah,
like San Francisco as an and maybe this is good for us because we have been at the forefront of a lot of things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we were at the forefront of like new way of cooking, mm-hmm. And Summer Siskin allowed us to do that. It was like not like, oh, no, you need to do this and you can't do other things, you know. Yeah. So it's, there's some type of freedom that happened. And it's almost like a place where obviously you have to work hard. You got to be thoughtful and conscious. But no one's going to judge you.
Yeah.
Unless you hurt someone.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, not just for the cooking, you know, I mean, politically and yeah. also, you know, a lot of activisms happen in San Francisco, yeah. and it's, I think it's beautiful. That's what humanity...
It's part of the culture of
yeah,
that
but
city.
That's, yeah. San Francisco is humanity.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's like what humanity should be.
Has that been a constant for you? Do you feel like that's just been that way since you first arrived and it's just like been pretty much... consistent?
Yes, but I think the last few years have been I've been a bit upset. I don't know if maybe upset with the tech industry
mm-hmm.
because what happened is I think it's great they came in and you know there's a lot of innovation, but what happened they displaced a lot of people
because people got priced out.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then I think just the homeless population is...
It's crazy.
It's crazy. And that's not right.
Yeah.
Everyone has the right to have a roof under their head.
Yeah. Yeah, for people who haven't been there, I mean, there are like little tent cities almost now.
Yeah, tent city. And it's so funny because if you talk to them, because I've talked to them, because I've been interested in that for a long time, mm-hmm. they're not like people think, oh, they're mentally, you know, it's like, no. There is people that live in the tent and they go to work every day.
Mm-hmm.
Or there is young family that were very well educated and they just can't afford it.
Right.
This is not right. They say we are in one of the richest country in the world.
Yeah.
One of the richest city in the world.
For sure. Well, this goes back to the, right, and more rich than ever.
What
right
are
now.
We doing?
Yeah.
If we don't take care of the others, of
yeah.
human,
yeah.
we're not taking care of us.
Yeah.
We are becoming greedy and selfish,
yeah.
and this is that's something that just really.
Yeah.
So I'm. I think a lot about this, and mm-hmm. I would love to do something that is could help and more yeah. impactful. And I mean, I'm just a cook. I don't, you know,
so
I don't
funny.
Have the money behind me. But like, I know there is people out there that will. We need money to do things.
Right, but it's so funny. You just said you were just a cook because I do wonder how you. Categorize yourself, right? Because you very much strike me as someone who has sort of an artist temperament,
yeah,
or point of view. You know, the way you're famously the way you write your menus, right?
The poem, yeah.
The poem, right?
I can't write either way. I can write either way, yeah.
No, but I mean, you do touch all the. You have a very distinct visual style. Your food,
yes.
These are all. I mean, that's obviously culinary, but the other things are not. And you know, you're talking now very much about, you know, societal issues. Do you really just, when you say you're just a cook, do you really feel that way?
Well, I mean, I think I say I'm just a cook in a way that I don't have the power of the money, but what I have is the power of my voice.
Right. You have a platform.
I have a platform.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I want to address that it's very important. Doesn't matter what job you do in your life, you have to be able to get, you have to be engaged about the surrounding of mm-hmm. where you live mm-hmm. or in the world. You
yeah.
You have to use your voice.
Yeah.
Don't be complicit and silent of things that,
right.
don't think that you are here, you have a job and you can't. You are a human, you have a voice.
Yeah.
You know, humanity is really, it's a major of things right now. If we don't speak out or help things or see things that we can change,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't matter where you are. It doesn't matter if you make $50,000 a year or if you make $5 million mm-hmm. a year. You have a voice.
Where does this come from for you?
My father.
Your father. He had a very strong sense of
yes.
right and wrong, community.
Yes. Yes.
Did he talk about those things?
All the time.
He did. So he made a point of instilling this in you.
Yes. He told me. So my father got into a place of power, being, you know, a politician.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, I'm elected. Or someone put me there.
Mm-hmm.
Or I've been given the chance to maybe work with other, you
yeah.
know. But you always have to remember that the reason I'm here because it's others. And those others put me here because they trust me. and they trust my voice. Mm-hmm. And I'm here to make sure that everyone will be represented. Mm-hmm. I'm not elected to be a powerful person. See, this is the problem in America or in the world. People look for power.
You mean that's the goal? The goal isn't the end result. The goal is the power itself.
It's the power itself.
Yeah, I agree. Well, now more than ever.
But if you want that power, you've been giving that power from others, from the people. We are the people. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I don't know, it's very, you know, very selfish, very hypocrite. Mm-hmm. It's like this world needs to stop that. You know, mm-hmm. we need to be in a world where, yes, obviously we need people to help us to mm-hmm. go through things, you know, and politically and all that. And people have, you know, I mean, you're a journalist. I can't do a podcast. Maybe I could.
You?
I don't know. But, you know, everybody has his own skills.
If you want to come co-host with me, we'll do it.
But everybody has his own skills, but yeah. doesn't mean that we are better than others.
Yeah.
But we need each other.
Right.
And
so you don't see the relationship with the press as... you don't see a wall between the two worlds. What you do, what the press does, what your customer... You don't see those as... You see those things as all being united, ideally.
Ideally.
Yeah.
Not always.
Yeah.
There is press and there is press.
Yes, right.
So.
Okay.
But I think it's interesting, you know, and I think I have to look at, you know, my position today, you know, and who I am. Obviously, I'm human.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't know where I come from, but I'm a person of the world, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also a woman.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking, it's like, wow, I have a voice. And then I'm looking around to all those women and little girls around me. Just, and all these emails getting, it's like, I want to be someone that hopefully can help
mm-hmm.
to forge the way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have all the answer. But it's interesting, I went to see this, the movie... with Ruth Ginsburg.
Yeah, on the basis of sex. I haven't seen it yet.
Amazing.
Amazing. Why?
Amazing.
What's so good?
You know, what is telling you that we, the rights of women, it's not that long ago.
No, it's shocking.
Shocking.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember there was a famous, it's one of my heroes, Simone Veil was a French politician.
Yeah.
She passed away, I think, a year or 2 years ago. And she's the one that wrote the abortion laws in France. Mm-hmm. And she's also a survivor of the Holocaust.
Mm.
And through her life, she was dedicating a life with the rights for women's rights.
Mm-hmm.
Human rights and women's rights. And, you know, it's not about being a feminist. It's about being like, I'm also human. We have to have rights, you know. But,
yeah.
you know, when I watched this movie... what was interesting is America tell you that how equal everybody is, but when you look at laws, there is so many laws against women, against race.
Of course.
It's not there. And it's just so messed up. So I am here to speak about it. Mm-hmm. I don't know everything, but I want to have a voice, you know, and I'm like, hey, there's a lot of work to be done.
You know, it's interesting because I've said it on this show many times. I'm always hesitant to ask women chefs to speak about being a woman chef, right? Because my feeling is that nobody, you know, you want to be a chef, right? You don't want to be a woman chef. You don't want to be a gay chef. You don't want to be a black chef, right? But you were one of the chefs I think about who's, you're out front on this. You brought it up in this interview, this particular topic.
Yeah, but...
Do you wish you didn't need to talk about it? Are you happy to talk? What's your emotion about that as a topic that comes up in interviews that you feel compelled to bring up?
Well, the things that I wish that people will not do is to put us in the category.
Yes.
And then having some stupid hour to put us in the category, it's like already putting us down. What I think is that we have a position as, you know, a job is a job. I could be an actor, I could mm-hmm. be a photographer, I could be, but I'm also a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that it's not because I'm in the power, you know, I'm lucky or that I'm going to shut up about who I am physically.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's a lot of work to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think when I remember my dad used to told me the day that we, if one day you've been, first of all, you have a voice. But if that voice is, that voice is given to you in a much more amplified, always use it to make sure you understand where you come from mm-hmm. and help others. Mm-hmm. And that's important to me. Mm-hmm. And I am. I'm a woman. I just, I'm sorry, but like I am. I should not say sorry.
No, I don't. I mean,
never say sorry.
Right. But what I'm wondering is. Is it a burden for you to talk about it?
No, you know what? It's not a burden. There is no burden in life, or there is no failure. There is always opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Are you religious? Can I ask you that?
No.
I can't ask, or you're not?
No, I'm not.
You're not. So this is just Dominique's view of the world.
This is Dominique's view, and I come from a Catholic family. Mm-hmm.
What kind of kid were you? Were you, you know, you mentioned wanting to be yourself, you know, when you decided to leave France and come over. Were you kind of always sort of irrepressible? Were you always sort of Dominique Crenn like a child version of who's sitting in front of me, or did this
probably
was this
yes.
someone who evolved?
So yes,
later
I think so. I was a tomboy, and
you
I'm still a tomboy.
Okay.
I had a lot of friends, but I was a loner.
Yeah.
I always defended people that didn't have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the first instance was my friend Sebastian, and he was I don't know, I was maybe 8 or 9 years old, and Sebastian was shorter than me, mm-hmm. skinnier than me, mm-hmm. and then people were bothering him, and I just took on to defend him.
Verbally or physically?
That was verbally, this one.
Mm-hmm. This one?
This one.
There was another one where you had to...
The second one was at school when I was at the Lycée Rabelais. Remember that? There was this guy, his name was Bido. And he was not a part of the school, but he was one of those like, kind of like, you know, kids that were outside of the school, like, you know, waiting on his motorcycle. And he was bothering someone. And I knew who he was mm-hmm. because, you know, I mean, Meudon was a very small city. And yeah. I basically told him to stop, to bother those people mm-hmm. or, you know, to bother anyone. And he got aggressive to me. So I basically grabbed him and threw him on the top of a car. It's true. It's a true story. And then... everybody was looking, and the parents were outside. Everybody's looking, and I guess my dad got a phone call. Your daughter is fighting with someone. Mm-hmm. And the principal of the school asked me to come back, and she said, Dominique, you can't do that. And I say, if I can do that, you guys need to do that. Mm-hmm. You have those kids that has been harassed and bullied by those guys that don't have anything to do with the school. You guys got to put a system in it. You know,
how old were you when this happened, roughly? Is it like 15, 16?
Yeah, I was probably 12 or 13,
really?
Yes.
Okay.
Maybe like 14, maybe. Uh-huh. Yeah, maybe 14.
Okay.
But I had an instance before that with my brother. And then I remember I came home and my dad was like, what did you do? And I explained him exactly what I did. And he said to me, listen, very proud of you, but violence not going to get you anywhere. And I said, I do understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would make sure that I... And I said, Dom, this is the second time. Because before that, I was in England, and someone was bothering my brother or whatever, and mm-hmm. I just knocked them down.
Did you surprise yourself in these two instances when it happened? Like, was it almost involuntary? Like, was there any thought involved when you did it, or did it just happen? Like, was it almost like an animal instinct for you to respond that way?
Yes, maybe.
Interesting.
I don't think I wanted to go and beat up someone. Mm-hmm. I was like, I just need to shut them down.
Mm-hmm. And that was the only way you knew to do
it. But it was very interesting because I knew that if someone, especially a little girl,
yeah.
beat the shit out of them, then they're like, suddenly they're just going to realize that's like, shit, what did I do?
Right.
And but that was kind of like, you know, I never like people that bullied other. Yeah. I never liked that.
That is something I got to tell you, not physically is one thing, but one of my least favorite things in life, and something that will just turn me off to people right away, is when they are cruel or even just mean, disrespectful.
What words you
to
very,
people who yeah. don't have any, I mean, even yeah. like somebody, to put it in terms of your business, even somebody who's awful to like a server or a waiter.
Yeah.
I hate that.
That's terrible.
I think it is one of the ugliest things that will absolutely yeah. turn me off to somebody. Like almost, I almost can't be fixed. Like I just will absolutely lose my interest in somebody over
well,
there.
Well, I think words is very powerful, but also very damaging.
Mm-hmm.
And I always try to not, I'm very careful with words. Mm-hmm. But when I say something, I mean it. I will never say something to degrade someone.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Right.
But I had a couple of instances that there's some guests that were disrespecting my server mm-hmm. at Atelier Crane.
Mm-hmm.
I throw them out of my restaurant. I'm like, there is no place for you to be here. And I think that's important. And nobody's taking the stand. There's a lot of people let things happen.
Yeah. I'm sure your staff appreciated it.
This is normal. I mean, but the thing is I don't want any of my staff either to degrade someone.
Yeah.
It's like, where do you get that? Yeah. Who do you think you are?
Yeah.
But we are in a society where I think a lot of kids are not taught how to be. You know, there is a very interesting, and I talk a lot about this, there's a documentary called The Mask We're Living In
from okay.
Jennifer Newsom.
Okay.
She's the wife for Gavin Newsom.
Mm-hmm.
And
The
new governor. But yeah. that documentary was done like a few years ago.
Yeah.
But it shows you how, you know, we're all born equal.
Yeah.
And then there's one, at one point, we take the girl one way and we take the boys one way. And right. we tell the boys to not be a pussy or to not mm-hmm. cry or to
yeah.
be, you know, and then we tell the girls to do other things. But at that moment, then you mentally, you're already damaged.
Mm.
And you're not teaching them how to be.
Mm-hmm.
Just, can we teach the kids to be just to be?
Mm-hmm.
Not a boy or a girl, just be yeah. a human.
Yeah.
Teach them that.
Yeah.
It's so different. The world will be so different.
My observation, I have kids, right? I have twin 14-year-olds, boy and a girl. I had a realization in the last year or two. I have to say that growing up, I almost thought of girls when I was, I'm saying girls because they were like kids, right? Almost like a different species, right? Like, it wasn't until I was an adult that I was like, to use your term, we're all just humans. Just, you know, we have different bodies and different, right?
Yeah.
And different chemical makeup
yeah.
to some extent.
Sure.
But that is an evolution, I think, that people need to come to. I think for a lot of kids, there is such a, like you just said, there's such a difference in the way your gender is defined and the expectations. And I think it is still like that. Well, I mean, we like to
yep.
pretend it's not.
Sure.
But also, you know, you're in San Francisco, I'm in New York.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big world out there. It's a big country between, you know, our states. And
sure.
there's a lot... You know, everyone thinks a lot of people I know think, you know, there's this enlightened way of eating now. Oh, everyone eats healthy now. No, they don't.
Like, no, they don't.
Obesity is still a huge issue. And, like, people who don't, those are people who are very nearsighted, you know.
But I think that's interesting because it's like, so now how do you, it's not about fixing, it's about understanding what's happening right now and trying to find a way to educate.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you do that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I truly believe that the government's not going to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
They are there.
On this front, yeah. Yeah.
The people, you know, I think, I don't know if we, I'm curious and I like to change and
sure.
I like to change my idea, but like I think it needs to start at the beginning maybe with parents and, you know,
sure.
the way the education is also, and I feel that there is... The education also at school need to change a little bit, you
mm-hmm.
know. I have to tell you, so my ex-partner and I, we had, you know, she had twins. I mean, I'm the second mother.
Mm-hmm.
And They're 4 years old.
Boy, girl?
Two girls.
Two girls.
Yes. And I think it's important, you know, that they go to this world without no labels.
Right. No boundaries.
No boundaries.
Right.
And we just have to do that, you know. And
right.
I think we need also to start that the education way of, like, at school. And
yeah.
I don't like you. Do not say hi to me. Hi. Happy New Year.
Emeril Lagasse just walked in and stuck his tongue out at Dominique Crenn.
I'm glad you made it.
Yeah. Is he good looking?
Chef. Well, that changed the topic.
It's nice.
Switching gears for a second,
because
we only have a few minutes left. Your style of food, when did you come... Obviously, it's something that's probably, I'm sure, still evolving, but... When did you have a sense of the kind of food you wanted to cook, of what your style was, of sort of what your lane was? You know, you just talked about letting people grow up without a lot of boundaries on them. In cuisine, there's a ton of boundaries and a ton of tradition. But when did you start figuring out what your voice was going to be, or what you were interested in, and what made you on the plate?
But, you know, it's interesting. So when I work at Stars, I knew after Stars that I needed to be more educated about the food scene and the way to cook and all that, but I knew that the food that I will do will never be like others. And I knew in a very early time that food was language and the way to express yourself. It's like you're a painter, then you paint. I don't know how to paint. My dad knew how to paint. And I felt that food could be a vehicle for me to express myself, ideas or things like that. But I knew I couldn't do the cutty-cutter cooking or cuisine.
Just
like. And it's interesting because when you take old... See, I don't follow recipe. I hate recipe. But if you look at old recipe, I'm like, it's just base. Someone started to do that. But if you're smart enough, just take those basic and just... You understand flavor and all that, then you can do your own thing.
Yeah.
So it works for me.
Yeah. Hard to put it in words, right?
It's a language. It's a,
food is a language.
Yeah, it's a language, It's your own way of expressing yourself. It's like, you know, like if someone see a plate that I did somewhere online or in a book, they know it's me.
Yeah.
Because I have my own personality and I want that.
Yeah.
But there is a purpose when I do things. It's not just I'm putting food on the plate.
Mm-hmm.
It's true. But early on, but I didn't know how to do it early on. So, but I knew this.
So it was a lot of trial and error, experimentation, and just kind of going with your gut.
Yeah. Yes, and I think Atelier Crenn was probably the beginning of my journey. One of my journey. I had a lot of journey.
Okay. Well, we're out of time.
Why? Why? There is always, you see, there is rules.
Well, the rules are that I'm got another group of chefs, and they only gave me 40 minutes with you.
Okay. That was a pleasure.
But I'll happily sit down with you again this week if you want to give me some more of your beach
time. Yes,
for real?
Awesome. Yeah, for real. Right. Awesome. All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much, chef.
Au revoir.
My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel, Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit Koren.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Dana Cowan, and I'm the host of Speaking Broadly here on HRN. Every week, I conduct intimate interviews with the brilliant, powerful women in the food world. We discuss their lives, their careers, and the ways in which they navigate the world at large. You can find Speaking Broadly wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. Just a quick reminder, especially for those of you who are new listeners, if you want to subscribe to this show, it is free. It is the best way to keep up with us. Episodes just appear in your feed when your feed refreshes. If you don't know how to use the podcast app, which, have you ever found this, Meredith? There are a lot of people who don't even know they have a podcast app.
I don't use the podcast app.
You don't use it?
No, I use a different one.
Do you do Stitcher or something?
I use Downcast.
Okay,
actually.
Yeah.
I'm not plugging anything. Okay. They all have their issues.
Yeah, but some people don't even know that there's that little purple microphone that comes with your phone. If you open it, it's just like opening a music app.
Yep.
It functions basically the same way. You search for podcasts, you subscribe, it's free. I suggest you do that. And if you don't want to do that, you can follow the show at Chef Podcast is the handle. That's at Chef Podcast. Every time I drop a new episode, there is an image that goes up, and the link is in the bio, and you can go to the Heritage Network page for that episode. And from there, you can navigate to iTunes or Stitcher, or there's some other options. You can listen however you want. But those are the two best ways to keep up with us. Okay, this is a long show, so I'm now going to go into the next interview, which was, I consider this a shop talk. I'm not in the industry. I write about the industry. But I consider this a shop talk episode with Emeril Lagasse, Andrew Zimmern, and Amanda Cohen. Amanda Cohen's with Dirt Candy in New York City. Emeril, of course, is a legend and mostly associated with New Orleans, although has restaurants in other places. And Andrew Zimmern, of course, is in the Midwest and is known to most of you from television. And these are three people. Amanda's of a younger generation. Andrew and Emeril are sort of peers. I've written about both eras. And I just thought it'd be fun to sit down and sort of talk to them about where they think the industry is headed, how it has changed. And they also end up giving some really solid, just nuts and bolts advice for you younger chefs and cooks out there. They give some really good advice about pacing your career, about the importance of lawyers versus agents.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. About business deals. We don't get into too much, we don't get too geeky about all this, but it's enough, I think, for people to take and run to various advisors in their life and make use of the info. I think
nice.
It's a really cool conversation, and because it's the three of them, it's fun. So
yep.
it's not like sitting in a classroom. So we recorded this interview at the Restaurant 7 here on the property. In the middle, it was before dinner service, so we had the place to ourselves. We took a booth, and the three of us sat down. We had to share one. Well, I only have two microphones, so we were passing microphones around. Hopefully, I'll have been able to edit around the awkward moments that led to. I promised them I would. And I don't think I need to say any more about that.
So it was a literal round table.
Yes, it was nice. A round table. We are going to go right into it. So here you go. This is my interview with chefs Emeril Lagasse, Andrew Zimmern, and Amanda Cohen. I hope you enjoy it. This is the first year, 2018, that I started periodically, once in a while, getting invited to stuff like this. It's the greatest thing ever. Is it not the greatest? Amanda, there's like a circuit. There is an event circuit. There are people you see on the road, you in far-flung places. Is it not?
Yeah, but I've seen you at other events before on the road. But this is, I have my own personal handler. She follows me everywhere, makes sure I get to events and stuff. So
you
I
mean here pretty, at the at
yeah.
this festival?
Yeah, at this
they've
one.
Assigned
everywhere
someone
I
to
go,
you.
Lavinia goes. She's amazing.
What politicians call a body person.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I assume she's there to make sure that I show up on time and I'm not, passed out on the beach.
Right.
I'd like to know what happened in past years so that we all have to have our own handler.
I have the best. She's been with me, 3 years.
But
But don't you think it's one of the things, because that circuit that you're talking about, we've been on that roller coaster for longer than most people in one form or another, and it's what makes this really special, is that they really want to make sure that you're able to enjoy yourself, and it's not so much about largesse or about need, as if there's irresponsibility, but it just makes life, it's just a really nice little perk, and I'm blown away by it. But it's there, I know that, because Eric has talked about this, and maybe you can speak to this, the idea is that if you're comfy and you're taken care of, that's going to come down to the guest. And to me, it's that Danny Meyer school of hospitality. The most important people in the restaurant is our staff. Because if we take care of them and they're happy, then we can actually give hospitality to the guest. And without that, you can't.
Well, it seems to me also it allows you all to focus on whatever you're doing in any given moment, whether it's prepping the meal that you're going to be doing, getting ready for the demo, or enjoying the leisure time you have in between. Because you have a human alarm clock who's going to come get you, and you can, like, stay in... Yes, Emerald?
I'm frightened about the human alarm clock.
The human alarm clock? I'm sorry. And we just met for the first time ever.
So
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I should have saved that for later.
But I do have that in my mind. Like, if I'm not on time, Adriana is going to come and yank me by the neck.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so I have to be on time, which I've had no time since I've gotten here. But I do remember Adriana's coming to get me.
Right.
You know, so
can
all good.
Be honest with me, guys. You know, I also write about tennis a little bit, and I've talked to tennis players about this. You know, like, they refer to, like, ducking out on the media sometimes, you know, or, like, you know, you come to an event like this, and there's a lot of media here. There's a whole group of us. It's like a press corps. Does that get tired for you, you know? Does it get tired answering the same questions? Just in general. I'm not talking about the Cayman cookout. But just in general, I mean, you guys, especially you two, have been at this for so long.
I think they've done a great job of spacing it out. I don't think that they bombard us. There are a lot of you here that are from all over the, you know, all over the world. But they do a great, great job of spacing out, at least my feeling. There was my first year, it was a little bit munch, which was 3 years ago. They just kind of pounded. Yeah. But I think they've done a great job now overall.
So you can actually get into the conversation and...
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, why do this if we only have 10 minutes?
Right. Right. There's no...
You know?
Yeah.
Without Andy Roddick running out of the room on you.
Well, I wouldn't have come for 10-minute interviews. Like, as much as I want to come hang out in the Cayman Islands,
I think what's really interesting, and you know, Emerald, maybe you feel the same way, is that over, you know, our lifetime in food, not only has the food world become more widespread and diverse and more interesting and multi-layered and leveled, but the opportunity and ideas of writing about it. I mean, it used to be you could do a restaurant review, you could do a culture roundup, you could do
a
an ingredient deep dive, or a recipe.
Or a trend piece.
Yes, or a trend piece.
Right, things on
and
three
now,
menus around town.
Now, there's so many different ways to approach it, and quite frankly, I'm as charmed by the young local blogger that I spend 10 minutes with, who's just asking me, the one question that I don't care to answer from some people, but is so charming coming out of her mouth when she's asking me, what's the worst thing you ever ate? And it's like, you know, that's 1,000 times a day for me. But
that's what I meant by my
earlier
question.
No, but it's so charming coming. Here's a young person starting their career, and I've been on record saying, you know, just start it. Start your blog. There's nothing more democratic. Go do it.
Can you say ban?
Absolutely. Exactly.
Do you still you get that all the time?
How many people come up a day to you and are like, you know, bam, and
think
that's fun?
Fire.
Yes.
The questions over and over again, this is why we are and who we are and how we make money. Yep. So I am Chef Amanda Cohen when I am here. I totally 100%, I mean, maybe when I lock my door, I'm somebody else. I don't have split personality. That must sound weird. But here, I'm on. I'm Chef Amanda Cohen, and I will do the job that's expected of me. And that's okay, you, because this helps my restaurant.
But it also, your brand, I mean, the stuff that you write, you know, is so interesting. And you tackle big ideas, right. And you're not short on opinions, and you're super smart. And you're such an impressive person. And I think when you're having a conversation with someone, I mean,
we've had
this talk. But no, it's true. It's true. I mean, I read there are people when I see that there's a new thing that you've written for someone, I like go and read it or tag it and set it aside because I know I'm going to read it that night because it's always provocative and it's always interesting and it's always from the heart. And you know, it's reflected by having people like you. I mean, we've talked about this before. I mean, you know, to be in conversation with you is different than being in conversation with someone else where it's the same 15 things over and over. So it works both. It works both ways.
And I'm very impressed that you don't have like a notepad in front of you. And
You want me to be honest? I got rid of the note. I stopped using a notepad in the last couple of months because I just feel like it's one more thing that gets between me and whoever I'm talking to.
Yeah, no, I agree.
So I do research.
Yes.
And
you have to.
And I yes,
so do
but
we.
I don't bring notes.
So do I.
I don't
so
bring
do,
notes anymore.
So do we.
Yeah.
But to sit there and you know read off of a notepad about what's the worst thing you ever ate? You know, it's like
right. You're just working your way down a thing.
That's exactly right.
Okay. So enough about my craft. Let's talk about your guys' craft. There's a question I'd love to ask you. I was just chatting, unfortunately, after we finished our interview, but with Dominique Kren. You know, I was on.
She's French.
She's the one you came in. gave her the Bronx. What do they call it? The Bronx. You gave her the Bronx cheer when you came in the room. You know, I have been I did a lot of bookstore events and things last year, and I kept getting like the crystal ball question, right? Where's the industry going, right? And I don't know where. No one really knows 100%, but I did think about it a lot. And toward the end of the year, I had better answers because I really thought about it. I'm actually working on a piece about it right now, but I just would love all three of your responses to this. I think. So my big observation is that the reason that there are so many restaurants right now, and therefore so many restaurant closings right now, at least in the big cities, is that the restaurant business right now is not a supply and demand situation, right? There are so many restaurants because there's so many young people who want to be chefs or be restaurateurs, right? And there's more restaurants than most. What's that? But they don't have it. It's cruel for you to say that, Emeril.
No, because what Emeril means is, I mean, he gets this. I mean, we've talked about this before. You get it 10 times a day. I get it 10 times a day. From the kid who just did a stage at some Scandinavian one-star Michelin restaurant is looking for a job in a good kitchen in America, asks our advice at a food festival, and then when everyone is looking the other way, says, hey, and by the way, how do I get my own TV show? And it's like, do you know something? Work hard, build a brand, and like us, dumb luck. I mean, you know, like, you know, bon chance. I mean, it's not some sort of, I mean, everybody wants the brass ring without working for
this
it.
This is one of the other, I'll get back to the question. I got to remember to come back to the question.
Don't lose that.
But this was one
question.
Of.
If he had written it.
Yeah, you would remember, where's the notebook? Come on.
You know, I feel like, no, but yes, that was the original thing. But to the point Andrew was just making, I feel like the template has flipped from when you two, Emeril and Andrew, were coming up, right? And what I mean by that is it used to be that the way a chef got on television was you were a really good chef. Mm-hmm. That's what got you on television. Mm-hmm. You know, like Wolfgang Puck was one of the first celebrity, quote-unquote, celebrity chefs in this country. Was he a natural, like, celebrity? No, you know? Emeril, I don't know if you know this, but, you know, I've interviewed Lou Eckes, who media trained you. You know, I saw the thing you did for Shep Gordon a million years ago, right? You weren't born to television. You were a good chef who got noticed. And I think the template has flipped. And what I mean by that is now you can go on a show like Top Chef, name the show you want to name. You don't even have to win it, right? You can come in like fifth place. But if you have a shtick and a look and a whatever, you might be able to get backing for a restaurant, right? But no one's tasted your food.
No, because the food is secondary.
You're getting right, but you're getting the restaurant for having been on television instead of getting on television for having been a good chef. It's flipped.
It's flipped, but those restaurants still close pretty fast.
That's why so many restaurants are closing. Which is your first?
Is it though?
What? You know, that's a good.
But
part
I think
of it.
A lot of good restaurants are closing. I mean, Amanda and I have a friend in common, Jonathan Wu, yeah. who had a wonderful restaurant called Feng Tu. Rebranded it for about 6 months, and it lasted like 2.5 years.
Well, I think there's components that young cooks don't understand, and that is that you have to be a good cook, of course. The food's got to be great, but in today's time, you also have to understand the business. It's not even about the marketing; it's about the business.
What
it's
do you
about
mean
the
by
customer.
That?
Well, I mean,
are you talking on a real fundamental level that just hasn't changed ever?
Yeah.
And I think it all
starts with the arrangement. I think it all starts with the deal. And most of these guys are going into these restaurant deals that they have no idea what they're doing, and they made a bad deal.
What do you mean by this? For people who aren't chefs out there who listen to this, like, what do you mean by
the
a bad deal?
Rent's too high. The percentage is too high.
I don't understand what that means.
Right. You borrowed too much money, or you didn't borrow enough money. It's very complex. It's not just about, like, doing a brown butter in a pan. You know, it's more complex.
You're talking about people are setting themselves up for failure rather than success. You know,
why don't you try and learn more and get more knowledge before you know.
About business.
Right.
Do you feel like this is something that's underserved in culinary schools?
Yes.
But see, what's happened now is people are opening restaurants so fast, so they're not taking the time to learn. So,
meaning you don't have to get it. You could get it from a mentor. You could get it from...
Right, but so...
By having a mentor first.
It was like 15 years before I opened my restaurant, and I still think I opened it too fast.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm 25 years now into it, and I'm like, oh, every day I'm still learning so much. And so now you see kids who are opening it like 3 years, 5 years, and so they barely have the skill.
Yeah.
They're not really good leaders, and they have no idea what it means to be like financially responsible.
Yeah.
And then they do take really bad deals because you see everybody who's a chef partner, and everybody's like, ooh, chef partner, you own the restaurant. And then like 6 months later, they're out of the restaurant, and they clearly weren't really a partner in the restaurant, and they had some sort of shitty deal where somebody took over. Somebody bought them out right away. They used their name, bought them out, aren't paying them, and you know, they don't have a restaurant. I have a lot of feelings about it.
I mean, I often find myself comparing what you all do when you're, you know, at the beginnings of your career to people in the music business. You know, there's all these famous stories of people who signed away their whole catalog, right? Like Billy Joel did it, like got screwed three times, right? But there's all these stories. I think for young cooks, especially, you know, there is such a race to like open a restaurant.
You know, I don't want to turn on the gossip side of this thing, but there's so many people who take a look at that telegenic person who comes in fifth on Top Chef or Food Network star and has some money and realizes they can take a marketing shot with this food person at the front of it. And a lot of young culinarians who have some attention in this business are not only not good business people, but they're aligning themselves with the wrong partners. And there are some rapacious predators out there who set themselves up in these things. The flip side of that, quite frankly, is, you know, I always ask these, you know, young 20-something chefs who want to do their own restaurant, I say, are you ready to run and manage a $5 million a year business that brings, you know, pennies to the dollar on the bottom line potentially, and manage 40 to 80 employees depending on the size of your, because that's really what it is. It's not this glamorous, you know, world that you see on Hell's Kitchen or whatever. And people take a look at some people in their careers, and you know, we have three very different models here of people who own restaurants who also do other things besides restaurant stuff. But, you know, Emeril is, you know, I mean, legendary in this business, both as a chef, as an operator, and as a brand builder and manager. And I think, I mean, because we've talked about this, you know, away from situations like this, it is the hardest thing in the world to do is to keep customers coming back and to be able to survive the downturns, to survive the construction 6 months, you know, a block away on the corner down the street.
Yeah.
You know, what do you do about your food cost and labor cost? There's so many people just not equipped with the skill set to deal with the running of a restaurant. And it's very, very challenging work.
I just had Tom Colicchio on the last episode of this show, and he was saying they base, and this is someone who's obviously been on television for 16 seasons, is a very successful brand. He was saying they make most of his restaurants make their money in the fourth quarter. He said 2 quarters of the year they lose money. It's Tom Colicchio, you know? Yeah. It is amazing. Amanda,
I make
you
money
to,
in the summer because I'm vegetarian and everybody wants to eat vegetables for their vegan body.
Okay. So, well, first, I'm sorry, before I move on, all three of you, you know, you talked about predators, Andrew, and these, but what can, I do have a lot of young cooks who listen to the show, a lot of culinary students. What are there signs? Like in hindsight, is there a type? Is there something to look out
if
for?
If the deal is too good to be true, it is.
Amanda's nodding.
I'm 57, I'm not 27. If the deal looks too good to be true, it is.
So take a breath.
Get to know your
partners.
Stay
patient.
When I was younger, I always leapt at the first of everything. I leapt at the first special when I was dining in a restaurant.
Right.
I leapt at the first girl that said yes to a dinner date. I said yes. I'm a bright, shiny objects person.
Yeah.
To learn patience and to understand the word maybe, I think maybe the most valuable business tool that I've learned in the last 30 years is to train myself to say, I will get back to you on that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally has taken me 30 years to learn that all the time in personal relationships, in everything, because I make decisions, you know, too much on the fly. And if I just say, hey, no problem, let me get back to you on that. That has been the most valuable thing in the world. Research these people. See what else they've done. If you're going to go into a business deal with someone and be partners with them, you should know everything about them. I just opened up a restaurant in Minneapolis 12 weeks ago, and I spent a year and a half getting to know this guy and his business and all the rest of that before I decided to, you know, just do one business deal with him. Another chef that I'm partners with in Minneapolis and a bunch of restaurants and a catering company and some concessions stuff. I knew him for 10, 12, 14 years before we ever decided to do anything related where we both put money into a pile and did anything.
This isn't Gavin Kazin, is it?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like,
you got to watch out for that guy. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I mean, Gavin is the most, I mean, one of the best chefs in the world, but probably the most underrated manager of human beings
I once wrote of him,
in the restaurant business.
I once wrote of him that if cooking had a commissioner, it would be Gavin Kazin.
Yes.
He's
without a doubt. The best.
Okay. So,
here's the thing I want to add. I want to add to my friend what he just said. Couldn't agree more, my friend. Get to know them. The other thing is this. I have all of these young people that come to me and they say, hey, Emeril, I need an agent.
Yes.
Can you give me a good agent?
Yeah.
You know what? Go find a good lawyer
and
get to be friends.
That's
and
what you
trust,
were going to say, Amanda?
Okay? Right.
Go find, most important relationship
go find
have.
A great lawyer and then go from there. Because an agent, I'm sorry, okay? Whatever. Okay? A good lawyer.
It's everything.
That's right.
You're so protected, and, you know, often I sign a lot of deals, and, you know, let's say the deal is for, like, $20,000 for something, and the lawyer is probably going to cost me, like, $19,599. But it's worth it. It's always worth it, because that contract is so ironclad for me. Like, and without that, you know, you just go into the world so unprotected. And you want your lawyer working through. I don't know how to read contracts. I do now because I've asked him and we've gone through it and he's really taught me a lot. But I don't have time necessarily to read everything. And it is the greatest gift I ever gave myself.
My lawyer is our board chair for all of our companies. Mm. I speak to my agent every week. I speak to my business development guy every week. I speak to Tom, my lawyer, at least once a day.
For real?
For real.
That's amazing.
And
yeah.
I've known him of anyone on my team, 23.
Okay.
No, I've known Tom for 23 years, and he's the one who's helped me business strategize and business plan from the 10,000 foot above sea level. I'm lost without Tom.
I have to say, you know, this thing going back a half step to what you were talking about, like walk, you know, if this seems too good to be true, I think people don't think there's going to be another opportunity, you know, and you can look back through the history of this profession.
No, here's the deal. I talk about this a lot. You raise a super important point. We're raising a generation of people who are way, way more embracing of this quick, fleeting, scroll through it society that we have built up, where if it doesn't happen now, it's never going to happen again. And there are many, many phases in life. Everyone gets second, third, fourth, and fifth acts in life. I've had five, I think, right now. And people don't understand that what makes you happy isn't necessarily getting those things that only fills the hole for so long. So you have to have some maturity in your life to understand what it is that you actually want to do. I think the flip side of this problem that we're having right now, with so many people coming out of culinary schools and wanting to be chefs and all the rest of that, and maybe we have more restaurant seats than we have customers nationally or in certain cities. I happen to live in a city, Minneapolis, that's still growing mm-hmm. that way and explosively yes. and really interestingly in some amazing ways. So, you know, maybe not so much in Minneapolis. Maybe in New York it has. I don't know. But the fact of the matter is that what's going to be really fascinating over the next 10 years, and this is where those young culinarians ought to be spending their time investigating, is that you can be in the food business today in 2019 and be very successful and not be in a restaurant.
If you want to be in the hospitality business,
that's a different story, and there's a couple different yes. ways to do that. But I know 10, 12 different people. I mean, look at, you know, Ellen Bennett, who started Headley and Bennett, the apron yeah. company. He's one of the great entrepreneurs in America, an incredible leader, a super smart human. Worked for years in 3-star Michelin restaurants yeah. and 2-star Michelin restaurants. And just an entrepreneur. There are people I know in Boston who are going into the columnar aquaculture business, who are going into the candy making business, who are doing food adjacent or food directed entrepreneurship. You know, I mean, I'm lucky I bump into a lot of these people because I teach food entrepreneurship at Babson College. And I see them every day, young people who are doing insanely wonderful things without going into a restaurant, and the smart ones are looking at it, and they're doing it because the margins aren't great in restaurants.
But I love all that, but here's what I was going to ask before. Specifically people who want to be chefs, right? And I feel like this is already happening. It just hasn't been quite acknowledged, or the language hasn't caught up to it. You know, it's like we all have these things in our pockets called phones, right? But nobody wants to talk on it. It's a device is the more appropriate term, right? I feel like there are going to be chefs specifically, let's say people who want to actually serve food to customers in a live situation, right? But I believe there's going to be, and I just would like your guys' responses to this, I believe there's going to be people who are strictly pop-up chefs. That's all they will do.
Yeah,
they will travel. Again, yes, I agree
happening.
With that.
It's like,
there will be more food truck people. There will yeah. be people who only do breakfast. There yeah. will be, and I think maybe they won't even eventually, like 30, 40 years from now, all be called chefs. I think it may be something else.
You talk about these things called devices, right? So
right.
I was watching a thing the other night where they put two chefs in a room and they put an old-fashioned phone, like
a rotary?
Dial rotary yeah. phone in. They didn't know how to operate it.
Yeah.
They didn't know how to make a phone call outside of the room because all I know is this.
Yeah.
So here's my advice.
But that's okay.
Here's my advice, yeah. okay? You want to be a chef? Be a chef. Try going to the library for an hour a week. Try reading, which is what we've forgotten to do in this business about reading.
So I have to ask a question. I'll ask you, Amanda, because you were just saying yes.
Yeah. No.
What?
Maybe. I don't know.
No. No, here's the thing. I really try to always, people listen to the show hear me say this all the time. I'm 51. I wasn't around your guys, all of your business until early 90s. I came to it late as a writer. But what I was going to say is things change. Right?
Sure.
So, yes, people aren't reading as much, but they can go on YouTube and they can learn how to do everything. You know, there are these incredible shows like, you know, Mind of a Chef and Chef. So, instinctually, I'm completely like mind
melded with all of you. But is it real? Is it, you know, or is this just a kind of a refusal to acknowledge that it might, you might be able to get the same information in a different way?
You can get it a different way, but you still have to find the information.
I'm just asking the question, by the way.
And people aren't searching out the information. So to me, it's really like, it's so depressing to me that most of my cooks don't know the history of food in New York City.
Yeah.
You can, like, how are you going to be a great cook if you don't know what came before you? It's
right.
Mind-blowing to me.
Yeah.
So, you can, yes, you can get the information very quick and go online and learn how to make paella. But you know what? Does that have anything to do with culture?
Mm.
Does that have anything to do with understanding the people? Because if you understand the culture and the people, then you can understand the food, right? And I think that's what we're talking about as far as going. My son is learning how to cook right now, okay? He's 16.
Are you down with that?
He worked with Eric this summer for a month at La Bernardin. My advice to him and what he's doing, go read. Go read. Go to the library. Go read. Read, 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 and have a mentor.
You're talking specifically cookbooks? Food books?
Not necessarily all. He just got done reading Charlie Trotter's book about server standards, et cetera, et cetera. So it all pertains to the business.
Yeah.
But it's like you said, Amanda. You have to understand the depth, the foundation. It's not just the surface.
I thought I wanted to teach art history at one point. My parents said you need to get an education. You know, I went to college, I started studying art history, and, you know, the Impressionist painters all could draw as if they were photorealists. I mean, you know, they could draw a human hand as if it was floating in front of you, just like Raphael could. But then they decided to paint their impression of things, which is how that movement got its name, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's that same thing as, like, if you want to learn how to cook, turn chicken into a jelly bean, first you have to learn how to roast a chicken. And first you should learn everything there is to know about a chicken and what different cultures do with chickens and why the chicken is so important. And you need to learn all that stuff so that it's important that you have a relationship with it. And everybody wants the fast, easy, soft way around it. And I think the one thing that all three of us have in common, and we all had much different backgrounds and much different ways that we got to wherever it is that we are today, in different ages, in different cities. But the fact of the matter is, I think every single one of us, like all the people who are here today and a lot of those folks who interview, there is no substitute for patience and hard work, showing up early, leaving late, and being curious, interested, and remaining teachable in everything. People always ask me all the time, well, what do I do? How do I get this? Like, stay teachable, you know, stay interested. And I think if you're not naturally curious, I hate to say it, you're going to have to figure out a way to manufacture that, because when Emeril started saying, you know, read books, it's like, you know, he is naturally curious about everything.
Well,
and if it's not about how to cook something, it's why people do a certain thing. We've been at lunches together in Florida, where I know at least I get to see him and have lunch with him and sit at a table and talk. And we will spend an hour talking about a place that we visited together and the local culture that's there, because that's how you exchange ideas with other people.
But what I have to say is, to this point about learn this, to me, again, it's I'm conflicted, right? Because it's the nature of things to be different. I think one of the reasons people come to Emeril, your late friend Charlie Trotter, one of, like, a mind-blowingly well-read person, kind of a chef philosopher, Norman, another good friend of yours. I mean, but these people came to cook. They didn't come to cooking. You know, I interviewed Norman on this show, and he was like, at age 30, I hadn't been a sous chef. You know, I hadn't done this. I hadn't done, because he found it late. But I think the difference was a lot of people of your guys' generation came to it after having a tremendous amount of life experience, right? And now you have people who, I think of them as like culinary Quentin Tarantinos. You know, like, they've been watching movies their whole life, right? They decide really early they want to cook. All their references are food, right? But there's not a lot of other life stuff in that.
But that's what happens when you learn everything from YouTube.
Right.
YouTube is very valuable. You know, if I want to find a new technique or something, I can go to, you know, a Japanese website and watch 17 different high-end versions of tempura being made.
But there's no context.
There's no context. You have to bring something to the table if you're going to pursue it that way.
This is a profession.
It's
a profession, and it's one of the few professions where you don't actually have to know the history of your profession. It's probably the only one. And we want kids to succeed, and we want them to grow, and we're not really giving them the tools. So, you know, we watch Top Chef, and they do like, what's this? And they're like, I think it's an onion. And I don't know why they don't sit down and take a test. And they're like, who was this chef? And what did they teach you? And what's this? They're coming with nothing. And without that knowledge, you can't get better because you don't have the tools to learn.
Here's what I think is a and I'd love individually or somehow email, whatever, to let listeners know if we get anywhere. Here's what I think is the issue with that, because I went through the process of writing this book.
Right.
And what I realized was, unlike almost any... You want to be a painter. You can go to museums and you can look at it, right? You can look at paintings. You can listen. You want to be a musician. My daughter's taking drum lessons, and every week the instructor gives her five people to go listen to. Restaurants, when restaurants go, they're gone. Maybe there's a surviving cookbook.
Oh, yeah, except you have books and magazines and
I know, but
that
you
talks
can't
about it
eat
and
the
how
food.
You learn about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, but it's...
I didn't eat at Leslie Revson's restaurant. I wasn't around in New York City in the 70s, yeah. But I certainly know about it, and it's made me a better chef because I know what was happening with the food then.
Yeah.
And so I can play on it, and I can make that pineapple dish if I wanted
right.
to, and there's a history to that dish, and that's why it makes sense, and that's why certain things go together.
Yeah. This is going to be the last word because I got to let you guys go take a picture.
The history goes back, right? The history goes back because as I was, you know, telling you about EJ, about reading, the first book I gave him was, I said, understand this book. It's called Escoffier, mm-hmm. okay? Understand this and understand what the basics are. Don't try to memorize it and don't try to finalize it. Just understand the basics of it and then go from there. And that's what I think young culinarians today, they need the foundation. Mm. You cannot build a house if you don't have a foundation.
And you can also read the history of the city you're in. You know, Angie Marr, a lot of people, you know, are like, you know, $300 rabbit dish. This woman has immersed herself in the history of the city of New York and is trying to revive old recipes. And I think it's such an admirable thing. If you're cooking in New York City or Minneapolis or L.A., read the history of the culture of where it is that you are. Those days are behind us in a large part. But it doesn't mean that we can't learn everything about those times, because what's come before us is what's going to influence us moving forward. Yes.
Yeah. Well, this... We got to stop, but I will say there is an opening quote in my book, and it's David Kinch talking about what he calls the links in a chain, mm-hmm. and that you have to know this stuff to move forward. And I would agree with it personally. Okay, this brings us full circle because the handlers are waiting to whisk you guys away.
pretentious.
It's like when there's emergency. Emergency vehicles on a runway.
Yeah, I'm waiting to go back to the first thing you talked about, because when Amanda brought up this whole thing about you guys were talking about the circuit.
Yeah.
I'm like, that is a fascinating another topic. We have to do that another time.
I would love it. Yeah. To be continued. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you.
To be continued.
And as in the first segment, we are going to now go directly to another interview. This is the last interview of our Cayman Chronicles episode, recorded here at the Cayman Cookout. And this is with Chef Nancy Silverton, who is an absolute legend of the industry. Nancy first got known as a pastry chef years ago. Well, got known at Spago, where she was the opening pastry chef. Prior to that, she had worked at Michael's Santa Monica during the Jonathan Waxman era of that restaurant, its formative years. And as I'm sure people know if they've read my book or heard me talk about it, the opening crew from Michael's, not including Nancy, because she started actually as the cashier at that restaurant, but the opening crew of cooks is on the cover of my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. And I interviewed Nancy extensively for that book. That's sort of my only relationship with her, but this interview spans those early days and also what she's up to currently, how she got from savory to pastry and then now back to savory. I think people who know restaurants like Mozza and Cispaca maybe don't realize that this is someone who was a pastry chef and baker for the first 10 years of her life in the public eye. And then she sort of seamlessly made her way to the other side of the kitchen.
That's really interesting.
She also gives up the goods on two new projects she has coming up.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
I don't know if it's a scoop. I haven't Googled yet. I think she might have given it to me. Anyway,
right.
We have lots of detail on it and where the two concepts come from. Anything else I should say about Nancy Meredith?
She is just so chic.
She is, right?
In a word, chic. You didn't go on the stingray swimming adventure, but
yes, I was afraid.
There was well, she,
even though I'm from Florida.
No excuse. So she was,
I'm like the Roy Scheider character in Jaws. Like I live on the water, but
you don't want to go in it.
I've lived near the water, but look at this. Look at this beast. This was, rolling beast out front of us.
I mean, these waves are ridiculous. Yeah. It was choppy. It was choppy, but the stingrays are nice. But Nancy was there and she actually didn't get in the water. She was on a boat, on the deck of a boat, watching everyone swim with a glass of red wine in her hand.
Yeah.
Just looking like a goddess the whole time. This is like 10:30 in the morning.
Yeah, she had a glass of red wine in our interview.
Yeah, no, it was perfect. Yeah. She was just like a vision the whole time. Yeah, she's very cool.
Yeah, and her energy is just great.
And her food is awesome.
Yeah. So with that, this is the last of our, certainly not least, but the last of the four interviews from this Cayman Chronicles episode. The great Nancy Silverton. I hope you enjoy it.
So Nancy, I had this awesome lunch that you guys did today. It was great. I won't delineate the whole menu right now. Maybe I will have done it in the intro. But I was sitting there, and I had this crazy thought, right? Which is, you came up and were known forever as the queen of pastry on the West Coast, right? You were very early to the party. But now, you know, we sat there today. We had four courses, one of which was dessert, three of which were not. And it occurred to me, has anyone, like... When did you go from pastry chef to chef? I feel like it's just kind of been like accepted and a given, but it occurred to me, I don't know when that metamorphosis happened.
Well, you know, going way back.
Yeah.
And then going way back, I mean 1977.
Yeah.
When I went to the Cordon Bleu to study cooking.
Mm-hmm.
I think that... pastry being one of the dishes every day that I made, which probably every day I failed at. I always thought that I would never be in that world.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to that world through Jonathan Waxman. I applied to work at Michael's when he was the chef there.
Mm-hmm.
And when he hired me, the only opportunity was the pastry department. So I thought, as one should think, I'll do anything to get into the kitchen.
Wait a minute, I have to interrupt you on your own biography.
Okay.
First of all, I have to just say, for people who don't know, Michael's Santa Monica is a seminal restaurant.
1979.
Opened in April 79. You were living in Los Angeles. You were quite taken with the very sort of snazzy
scene. Well, I wasn't
scene
living
there.
In Los Angeles, by the way.
Oh, you weren't living there.
No,
you were visiting.
I had been living in Northern California.
Okay.
Where I worked at a restaurant in Larkspur, California called 464 Magnolia. I worked there the year before I went to the Cordon Bleu and the year after.
Okay.
But in one's own biography, you never know when really to start because it can be so lengthy.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to edit a little bit. So I kind of talk about my cooking world starting at Michael's.
Got it.
In 1979.
But what I was going to say before was...
Yeah.
your first job there was actually as cashier.
It was. So
okay. Is it okay that I'm saying
that?
It's in the book.
No. It is, well...
But
I didn't
think it's
know.
Interesting how you ended up in pastry.
But it was sort of that same segue into getting my foot in the door at Michael's. So when I originally applied at Michael's, after meeting Michael the evening before, I had just returned from my second time in Europe, but as opposed to going to school there, I went with my sister and a friend on $10 a day, and we backpacked, you know, through Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And when I returned, I decided to return to Los Angeles because at that time, the cooking scene seemed a lot more vibrant than than it was in Northern California, where I had been living for the previous 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, my parents brought me to Michael's, thought it was a terrific restaurant. I thought, this is the place I need to be. I met Michael. He said, come in tomorrow, meet my manager, tell him we met, I sent you in, see what he can do for you. So I met Carl, the manager, who was in charge of running we call it the POS system, the point of sale system, which encompassed the orders that the servers fed the person that was at that computer, and it went into the kitchen. Carl selfishly needed somebody to run that position at lunch. And so he let me know that the only thing opened at Michael's was that position.
Got
and
it.
So that's the position that I did take. And it lasted just a few weeks. I was terrible at it until Jonathan realized that I really did not want to do that. And he brought me into the kitchen, but he brought me into the pastry department, mm-hmm. which was the only opening. And so it was the second time in just a month that I said yes to a position that I really didn't want. What I wanted was I wanted to work on the savory side.
You wanted to be on the line.
Yeah, that's where I felt I belonged. You know, after my experience at the Cordon Bleu, where every day we cooked a menu, I did okay with the savory. But when it came to the dessert, nothing ever worked. You know, my soufflés didn't rise. Mm. My bavois didn't set. Mm-hmm. My crusts were not tender. And I always felt that I just need to get through that part of the meal.
That was like the cost of doing business.
Yeah, yeah. That's the cost of doing business. But this is not what I'll ever end up doing.
Yeah. But so the initial question, you went all the way back to this pastry, was you went, you did then become successful at pastry, to put it mildly. You were one of, you were really one of the people who helped.
There weren't a lot, you know, in those days.
Yeah.
But let me just say before that, so I worked at this restaurant, 464 Magnolia, for a couple of years, where I did savory. And then I went to the Cordon Bleu. So I had some foundation, I should say.
Yeah.
Now, when you credit me with being so successful, you have to look back to probably before most of your listeners were alive.
Mm-hmm.
And it was back in the days that very few restaurants had pastry chefs. Certainly in Los Angeles, everybody bought from three different dessert companies. So either you had a carrot cake on your menu, mm-hmm. you had a frozen chocolate mousse, mm-hmm. or some sort of a mousse cake, or you had either a pecan pie or a apple pie.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what the scenario was in Los Angeles. Probably in New York, there may have been a handful of more restaurants that actually had pastry chefs, probably the fancy French ones.
But there were also, just as a footnote, because I think it is so fascinating, I always think when I think of you in this story, Larry Forgione had a woman that he used. Her name was Lynn Bien, who made pies for him. She also baked pies for the River Cafe. And that was how Larry ended up meeting Buzzy O'Keefe and ended up at the River Cafe, was through that common purveyor.
Wow.
Or maybe, I don't even, purveyor is the right word. They both used the same baker.
Yeah.
But this used to not be uncommon. I know in New York, everyone used to get Amy's bread.
Okay.
Like, you'd go to dinner and everyone had the fennel raisin bread. Right. And the, like, these things now where restaurants have, all these programs, that's a relatively newish thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a newish thing, and there's a lot more talented people out there.
Yeah.
But, you know, Michael's was one of the few restaurants that that made their desserts. Mm-hmm. Another was L'Hermitage. Mm-hmm. Ma Maison was another. So we're talking about sort of established, not fancy, but certainly high-end restaurants. Mm-hmm. And that was what Wolfgang Puck wanted to do at Spago.
Mm-hmm.
And going to work for Wolfgang when I did in 1982...
That was the job you left Michael's for.
...was the job that I went kind of kicking and screaming. I didn't really want to leave Michael's. I was very afraid to leave, not ready to be a pastry chef, because at Michael's I was the assistant pastry chef. I didn't really know Wolfgang, but I went, and sort of the rest is history. So I have to say that to somebody else's credit, Wolfgang's credit, I was really at the right place at the right time, and thankfully I made desserts that people ate.
I'm not laughing at Nancy. Dominique Crenn just interview bombed Nancy. Yes, you were saying.
No, but I was, you know, everything is about timing, mm-hmm. and luck, hopefully talent.
Yeah.
But it didn't, my career didn't have to work the way it did.
You would have more happily, as far as you know, and knew at the time, gone along the savory path toward.
Well, not after Michael's. At Michael's, as I started to work with the pastry chef there, Jimmy.
Mm-hmm. Who was Jimmy Brinkley?
Jimmy Brinkley. And Jimmy Brinkley, so talented, And he had worked at L'Hermitage before working at Michael's. Mm-hmm. And he had a style of desserts that were so intriguing to me. You know, if you didn't buy, or if one didn't buy the desserts from the dessert the handful of dessert companies that were in Los Angeles, if a restaurant dared to put their own desserts on the menu, they always had a French name to them and one that somebody could identify mm-hmm. with. And when I went to Michael's, I was making desserts that didn't have French names, but they were called whatever their ingredients were. Right. So like chocolate raspberry mousse cake, you know, mm-hmm. Chocolate walnut tart.
Right.
And that was very new. And what he did for me, as he was my mentor, was that he showed me that dessert making could be lots of fun,
mm-hmm.
that there was so much room for creativity, mm-hmm. interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
And what was so special about it that I loved was that that we started work so early
yeah.
that we avoided sort of the difficulty of working in a cramped kitchen, which Michael's was not a large kitchen, and yeah. so many kitchens are not large. But what I love so much about it is that he and I did everything for ourselves. So rather than the way so many kitchens are set up in the United States, is that there's two crews. There's the prep crew that comes in and does all the slicing and dicing. Mm-hmm. And then the night crew or the line cooks come in later yeah. and they just take all of that prep work that's been right. done for them and then they cook the food.
Right.
And so oftentimes a line cook wouldn't be that happy with the food or the preparation mm-hmm. that the day cooks gave. But in the case of Jimmy and I, the way we worked, we did everything ourselves. So mm-hmm. everything we did was, I would like to say, perfect. So I ended up loving that part of the kitchen, one that I never thought that I would love.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went on to Spago,
yeah.
and I was the pastry chef there. And went on to start my own restaurant with my then husband, Campanile, but first opening La Brea Bakery and then Campanile.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to focus on La Brea Bakery, which was just bread at that time, for a good 6 months before Campanile opened. But then once I got to Campanile and I headed the dessert department there, but because it was now my restaurant, I had a big hand and a big say on the savory side.
So this transition began all the way back then.
So yeah, it began then. I mean, look at certain parts that I'm not comfortable with, you know, that I haven't done for a long time. So when I was back to this restaurant, 464 Magnolia.
Can we just say that? I think you described that. You're the only person who's ever mentioned that place to me, but I think you described it as sort of a restaurant. It was Northern California, and it was sort of the quick shorthand way to describe it was that it was not unlike a Chez Panisse situation.
Right.
There were a lot of like academic dropouts and grad students.
Right.
And
the similarities were that they were places that were chef-owned.
Mm-hmm.
There were places that were run by college-educated men and women.
Mm-hmm.
Basically self-taught. They cooked out of cookbooks.
Right.
So they were cooking like classic French stuff. Dedicated to local produce, which I didn't really understand. Mm-hmm. I was living in a small town when I started to work there called Petaluma.
Okay.
Where, because they found out I worked there, one of my jobs was to pick up the ducks.
Okay.
At Reinhardt, which is now, I think, called, Petaluma mm-hmm. Poultry or mm-hmm. something, which is still where we buy our ducks.
Okay.
But I would bring the ducks. It was a primarily California wine list.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all these things that were going on back, and now we're talking like 1975
yeah.
that I started working there.
Amazing.
And there was a lot of similarities as to the style of cooking.
Mm-hmm.
So there I did. I butchered fish.
Yeah.
You know, I made crepes. I cooked omelets.
And you had a natural...
I butchered meat. You know, I did all that.
You had a deft touch with all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah,
unlike
yeah.
pastry in your
right,
early
right,
days.
Right, right, right. But I did all of that.
Yeah.
But you get a little bit rusty. But I know how it should be done, and I know how I want it to be done. And that's how a lot of what happens in the kitchen is that I execute it and I supervise it, but I don't necessarily do all of it.
Right.
You know, the only, I mean, there's a lot of good things that have come out as far as taking care of people in the workforce and trying not to take advantage of people, right?
Right.
But I think that the one negative that has the negative takeaway is that no longer are people able to come in and just apprentice, do a stage, work for free.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that when I decided to drop out in my senior year in college, I was studying for my finals. By the way, it was the second semester of my. So if I need a college degree, I need to go back for one half a semester. But I was studying in the library, and I'm like, I'm not studying. There's nothing I want to do with a degree. And I called my parents, and I told them that I was dropping out. Now, my parents were both professionals. We're talking back in 1975, as I said. They could have disowned me. And instead, they were so supportive, including I had said that my experience over the last few summers in breaks between college and the summer break, I was getting jobs at sort of pseudo-French cafes in Los Angeles, where I was stuck in a corner doing one thing, and I didn't get to see the rest of the kitchen. I said, I would like to apprentice at what I believe is the best restaurant in this area. Will you support me if I work for free? Which they both agreed to do, because that's education.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to knock at the door of this restaurant, 464, and say, I would like to work here for free. And they were really astonished, but they allowed me. And
they were astonished.
Yeah, because no one had ever done that before. Now,
at that restaurant, no one had done it,
right.
But it was,
and
yeah.
And it's interesting because I don't really know where I came up with that idea of working for free, because I didn't really understand a French kitchen where all Europeans grew up doing that, you know, at 13 years old.
Oh, yeah, and across the country from you, there were all these people banging on the door of, you know, La Cote Basque, saying, I'll wash dishes,
right.
I just want to, I'll do it, you don't have to pay
anything,
me, whatever,
yeah.
Or going to France with no job and knocking on kitchen doors till they got one and didn't get paid.
And it was a fantastic experience. And by the time I worked there for a year and left to go to the Cordon Bleu, I actually was getting paid for a couple of the shifts where they had been short, and I was able to get
paid. You made yourself indispensable.
Right.
Yeah.
But you can't do that anymore.
Right.
You can't not pay someone, which is too bad because there's so many hungry people out there that would gain experience, but you can't hire them because you might be fully staffed at a restaurant.
Right.
Which is, you know, unfortunate.
Well, isn't it also, I feel like Dominique Crenn again. Isn't it, though, I actually had this conversation with your friend Mary Sue Milliken last year. You know, I feel like this is one of the dirty little secrets of the restaurant business, or it was when you could still not pay people, right? Which is the margins are so tight. You know, part of the business model of certain level of restaurant has traditionally been that you have some people there not getting paid. You know, I remember, I can't say the restaurant, but I ate at a 3-star Michelin restaurant not long, a couple of years ago, and there was this very elaborate thing presented to us. And when I came back to New York, I showed it to somebody who was also a 2-star Michelin chef, and I said, look at this. And the response was, well, yeah, I could do that too if I had 20 people working for free in my kitchen. But most people can't do. Look at how much work it was involved. You know, do you know how many hands touched that thing?
Well, the other thing
But that's always been part of it. And
a big part of it.
And I do, I'm of two minds. One is that I having come up in the film business and worked several summers for no money, you know, to get in, there are people out there who can't afford to do that, right?
Right.
And I do feel like it disadvantages them. And I do think the politics around these issues right now has become very facile and knee-jerky. But I have listened to that. People who have pointed that out to me, I've bought into that. Like, I do believe that is unfair.
Well, also, you know, I think it's not right for anybody to tell an employee that you need to come in on your own, not clock in.
Right.
But we demand those sort of hours. That's not fair. But if there is a cook that wants to come in off the clock just because they want to, there's so many legalities that prevent you from allowing that cook to come in on their own time because they want to learn another part of the kitchen or they want to be able to work slower to set up. Can't do it.
And you know what's funny about that? Right. And to me, I mean, I can't tell you how many – I mean, I mentioned to you right before we started taping that, you know, last year when I was on book tour, I had interviewed Tim Hollingsworth, you know, who I got to know. I wrote a book about The Book Whose Door. And that was, you know, he's one of people I think of who was just like a sponge for knowledge.
Yes.
And there's so many people who have become some of our best chefs who they were that person. They would finish their work if they were a prep cook. Hey, can I stay and help you at this station? Can I just be here during service and watch? Can I, right? And that really helped people advance, not only through the ranks, but in terms of their skill set. It's a win-win.
A win-win.
Yeah. Well, you can't do it anymore.
You can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
You know, for various reasons, including so many of those lawsuits where some angry cook and then turn and say, but I used to come in and I didn't clock in and I did, you know, this. And so you just have to be really careful.
Yeah. So in terms of the two disciplines, in terms of, you know, savory versus pastry, as someone who has done both in your career, do you come at those things differently? Do they?
I don't think I come to them differently at all.
In terms of dish development.
Well,
or?
As far as I think that I think each one in the end, I approach them that I need to make something that's craveable, right?
It's that fundamental to you. It's that broad to you.
Yeah, it's that it needs to be craveable. You need to say to me, I have been waiting to come back to Moza.
Yeah.
Because I want that butterscotch budino,
right? Right. And so what I used to call destination dishes.
Yeah. And you have to try that each dish that you make is a destination dish. So whether it's a little saltier or a little sweeter. But I think that they both can be complex. And I think, and I don't mean complex in the presentation or the amount of ingredients.
Or how much work.
Or
how many
much
steps.
Work,
right.
Or how many machines you plug in.
How many different things you put the food through.
No, I just mean that it has a complexity to it that's more than one note. So that a dessert is not just sweet,
right?
And a savory is not just salty.
Right, and things just aren't creamy or they're not, right.
Right.
Yeah.
But everything that applies, you know, texture, right? That's really important, you know, texture, acid and brightness. So many things are just so similar.
Mm-hmm. Do you have sort of in your head, when you go through developing a dish, do you have a... are there a certain number of marks you have generally in your head? Are there, is texture always a consideration?
Texture is always a consideration.
Is acid always a consideration?
Acid is always.
And savory?
I tend to really like acidic flavors. So hopefully in the lunch today that you had, your salad, you know, had a lot of preserved lemon in it. You had that.
The ravioli had balsamico.
That 25-age balsamic, right? Just a drizzle, but that's all you need.
I almost
need.
Licked my plate.
And certainly the lemon in the amberjack, both with the grilled lemons that we allowed you to season by yourself, but also the Fragola Sarda salad had a lot of lemon in there. So I definitely err towards that acidity in a dish.
It's funny. My friend Michael White has a line, no lemons, no Italian.
Yeah, is that it?
Do you agree with that?
I guess so.
Where else have you been recently? You and I saw each other in Vegas.
Okay, I saw you. What month?
That was October.
How about where I'm going?
What's the reaction? Does it seem like, you can't believe it's already been that long?
Yeah, I mean.
It feels like it was 3 weeks ago.
I can tell you that I was... I know I was in Italy for Christmas.
Oh, wow. Where'd you go?
So I went to my house in Umbria.
Okay.
But I also spent New Year's in Rome, went to see Dario, and went to Florence a couple times. I was there for 2 weeks.
Can you tell people who Dario is?
Oh, Dario Cecchini, like not only the most famous butcher in the world, but one of my dearest friends.
Yeah.
I'm I'm trying to cut down on my traveling this year because I do really miss being away from my kitchen. And I'm opening up a couple new restaurants next year.
In L.A.?
Yeah.
Can we talk about this?
If you'd like to.
I would. Before we wrap up, whatever you can share.
Are you sick of talking to me?
No, are you not? Oh, well, no, they have. Kidding. No, they gave us all these very strict schedules, so I try to be, you know.
Are you interviewing Dominique next?
I interview Dominique. No, you're my last interview of this trip. I could talk to you from now till Monday if you wanted to. So as much as you want to tell me and can tell me, the new projects, what are you up to?
I have two new projects next year.
So not opening until 20? Or next year, meaning the year we just started.
What year is this?
This 19? Is 19.
Okay,
but
so
barely.
One in 19 and one in 20.
Okay.
So you want to hear about 19 or you want to hear about 20? 19.
You won't give me both?
I'll give you both.
Give me both.
Okay, but I can tell you both because they're both like signed, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So the first one is a very small concept. It's going to be at a food court in Culver City.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know Culver City?
I do.
A small food court, probably no more than possibly 12 eateries.
Okay.
Which is very small in consideration to the large food courts that are going on. Culver City right now is on the brink of an explosion and on the brink because all of the large companies that are about to open in the next couple of years, from Sony expansion to Amazon to something with Google, but big places
are coming
with
in there.
A lot of people.
Yeah, and for Sony, and just so people know, when Nancy says Sony, the Sony lot is in Culver City
already,
it's, and it's no slouch in the size department.
Right, and they're building a subway stop in the middle of, I think there might be one at the end of Culver, but another one that's opening, and there's going to be a huge, huge new complex there. So there's going to be an influx of a lot of office workers that are going to need quick places to eat.
Mm-hmm.
I was offered a really great lease on a small place in this little food court that used to be a printing press. I don't remember if it was a newspaper or originally what I was going to do. I have a very dear friend who wanted to come to Los Angeles and partner with me in something. And this is what my original concept was my friend Franco Pepe from outside of Naples.
Who
that's what I feel like is the best pizzeria ever. But so we were going to go along and introduce Franco Pepe to Los Angeles through this very small operation, but it turned out in the end he really didn't want to do something so small. He wanted to do something bigger.
Okay.
And so I was kind of left with this space. So what I'm going to open up is something called pizzette, which is a French/Italian word for a small pizza.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that that's a nice size to feed a lunch crowd in all these office buildings rather than the size of the pizza that I do, which is still sort of small.
Are these small, like for one person
but
small?
But these are like personal pizzas, right? So it's going to be called pizzette, and I'm going to have these smaller pizzas. But I'm also going to do something that's called a stuffed pizzette, which is not stuffed like a calzone and baked, but just cooking the bread the size of a pizzette that will later be opened up and stuffed, kind of like a falafel in that sense.
Okay.
There's a sandwich place that I love in Florence. It's called Al Antico Vinaio.
Okay.
And what I love so much about their sandwiches, and there's like crowds going out the door, is that they're Italian in their restraint. So it's not like having a pastrami sandwich, right? So it's a sandwich that is relatively, it's not overstuffed. But it's layered with like lubricating flavors that when you take that bite, it all melds together.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I want to achieve.
Cool.
So that's will open probably end of the second quarter, maybe of 2019.
Okay.
But the big project that I'm really excited about, and I hope that I haven't, what do you call it? Gone over my head, or what do you say?
Like you haven't gotten in over your head.
Yeah, I hope I haven't gotten in over my head. But I'm taking over the food, and one of the bars at the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Wow. That's 2020.
Yeah, and that's going to be a steakhouse, an Italian steakhouse. So it'll be like a little bit of a hybrid between Kiesbacher and Osteria Mozza, a little bit of Carne Vino in Las Vegas. And I'm going to be naming it the Bearish, which is my father's family name. His last name is Silverton. But on his mother's side, he came from a lineage of farmers from Saskatchewan, Canada. They were cattle ranchers.
Okay.
They were responsible for introducing the aubergine black Angus to Canada. And that's what their life was. They were settlers, you know. They came in the early, late 1800s to Saskatchewan, and they were cattle farmers. So I'm going to be naming it after them.
That's great. And how do you spell that?
B-A-R-I-S-H.
Okay.
Bearish. And I feel like in a hotel with so much history as the Roosevelt, you want a name that feels like it was there forever.
Yeah.
And so I like the name. It feels solid.
Yeah.
I'm going to build a giant fireplace in the dining room.
Yes.
Hopefully, because I haven't done that yet. And we're going to do some cooking in the dining room.
In the fireplace.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. So... when you say Italian steakhouse, what does that mean to you? Is there a steakhouse? Is there a version of what we have in Italy?
There's a truck stop, which is an Italian steakhouse. The exit that I pull off of to go to my house in Umbria.
Yeah,
it's a truck stop, and it's an Italian steakhouse, and they've cooked
in
the fireplace.
This isn't a chain. This is a one-off.
No, it's a one-off.
Okay.
And they cook
What's
in the
called?
Fireplace. It is called. Butura.
Okay.
And Il Butura. It's really a truck stop, but it's definitely an Italian steakhouse with steak cooked in the fireplace and sausages and other things. And there's also pasta.
Side dishes?
Contorni. Absolutely.
Contorni. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. So was this sort of your inspiration?
They're all my inspiration. Right. But I think that, you know, and this is something that Joe Bastianich, my partner, always taught me, is that if you can't describe your restaurant in two words, then you'll lose the press. So I can't say, well, you know, I'm going to open this restaurant and I don't know, but like there's going to be pasta and I might have a steak and maybe there'll be a soup, you know, and then you're lost. So if I can say to you, it's an Italian steakhouse, there you go.
This is what people call the elevator pitch.
Yeah.
You're over there several weeks a year. You own a piece of property. Do you speak Italian?
No.
Okay.
You could tell by my pronunciation.
Interesting. Have you tried?
I try. I know the important words. Yeah. I know bicchiere. That's glass.
You can get through a restaurant
I know
meal.
Vino Rosso, because that's important. Right. You know, I know those kinds of words.
Nancy's actually drinking a glass of red wine as we sit here and interview. Yeah.
So I know the important words that make my life good there.
Got it. Okay. Well, I'm going to let you get back to your... I don't know. Are you cooking again today, or are you off the clock?
No, I'll tell you. Tomorrow, I'm going to be doing a 10-minute demonstration on a boat.
Yep.
And then getting right over to an event on the beach.
Yep.
That we're going to be doing Ruth's grilled cheese sandwiches.
Ruth Reichel's grilled cheese.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. I didn't realize that. Oh, cool. Okay. Thank you for making
time
for me here.
Thank you for being such a wonderful and interesting interview.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot coming from you. I appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of... I know you. It's work and it's promotion, but this isn't too shabby.
You know what? Like I said, if it was I would be really guilty. But I'm like, I worked today, you know?
Yeah,
I earned
Yes, you did a lunch today
tomorrow.
For a lot of people.
And a demonstration the day before.
Yeah. Yes.
So.
Yes. Okay.
And something tomorrow. So.
Yeah.
I am working for all of you out there.
Okay. Great to see you. Thank you.
You too.
And that's our show for this week. Meredith Heil, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You're good at this.
Thanks so much.
Have you done a lot of podcast interviews?
Have
you been
podcasting.
A guest?
I've guested.
Yeah, you're good.
Yeah, I'm featured.
You keep the mic. We're not using mic stands. You keep the mic in the right place. You got a good voice. You do fewer false starts than I do. And I do this once a week.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for doing this with me.
Yeah, it was fun.
Especially during your last, whatever, half hour of your... time here on the property.
And I can't complain. We're like sitting on the sand This beautiful ocean in front of us. A sea, I guess, not an ocean.
I guess maybe you wouldn't have gotten out to the beach one last time if it wasn't for me asking you to
that's
do this.
That's probably true. I'd probably just be in my room watching SportsCenter and packing.
Me.
So, yeah,
right.
That's
okay.
Perfect.
Okay. Well, thank you for doing it.
Thank you.
Hey, and if you're in Chicago, Meredith didn't ask me to say this. She just moved there. She's a talented writer. She's a good egg. If you're an editor, if you're a food editor, a drinks editor, a travel person, look her up. Throw her some assignments.
Thanks, man. I thought you were just trying to
she's
get me some
friends.
She's
a total pro. Or, well, I am trying to get you friends. As you know, I'm sending you to one of my good Chicago friends
yep.
separately. But you could also become her buddy.
Yeah, I'll take
she's
all
a lot of
it.
Fun. We've been hanging. A bunch of us have been hanging for the last few days. She's a lot of fun. Okay. Matt, our engineer at Heritage, thank you for splicing this thing together. I know it was a little extra work this week with the four segments. To all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening, and we will see you back next week on Andrew Talks to Chefs.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without the support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.